to episode 7 of Undumb. I think this is where things really start heating up, and that is, of course, Open Pass. And this is one of the premiere episodes of the series. Premiere with no E at the end.
It's okay.
Oh my god. So standard.
Well, no, okay. Look, okay. It obviously builds up to this one climactic moment, and that moment is fantastic. I'm not going to question that. But the rest of the episodes and the game itself are pretty lackluster, I thought.
Well, that's why I like this episode so much, because I noticed on rewatch, because obviously Jin-Ho, you know, rattling off 35,000 points or whatever with a two-color deck is the big climax of the episode, which is, of course, going to be massive, like have a huge impact on any viewer when they're watching it for the first time. I still think even on rewatch, when you know it's coming, this episode is still great because there's so much stuff in there that when you know what's going to happen just completely stands out. For instance, when they show the game rules to all the players, the cards that like the icons for each of the bonus decks was color-coded, but just the backs of the cards on the logo were all black. And likewise, the foil on the actual cards themselves are color-coded, but no one seemed to notice. And it's just only something you would pick up on when you know what to be looking for. And more to the point on that is Jin-Ho is just a complete afterthought for the first 45 minutes of this episode.
Yeah, because we know from the start that he's on the outs here. Let's talk about that quickly, because it seems like that was a response to Kim Gura going home. But Gura by that stage, his alliance had mostly crumbled around him. So I'm not sure why Jin-Ho was the one who had to bear that burden.
Well, I think, at least from my understanding, it was just the rest of the people, and who knows who talked him into it, probably Sangmin, thought that Pung and Jin-Ho were just too close to becoming a power pair at this point.
I guess, and, you know, if you don't want to blame Gura for the way the last episode went down, you can't really blame anyone other than Jin-Ho.
Yeah, sure. So the way this game is going to be played is you create a deck of 20 cards, you're going to open or pass them as you like to create an equation. The highest number at the end of that equation wins, and special decks are available at the price of 1, 2, or 3 Garnets. And, of course, this is, I think, the first time that we really see Garnets come into play. Like, you're going to have a huge leg up if you have a ton of Garnets now. Yeah. And as we see, Sung Yu has some Garnets, and he buys the first bonus deck and discovers that they have different colored backs. And, of course, in typical Sung Yu fashion, he tries to be discreet about this, but is not at all, and soon everyone in his group knows, everyone not named Jin-Ho or Pung, which is great. We have, essentially this episode is a majority alliance just buying up a ton of decks and swapping cards. No one wants to work with Jin-Ho or Pung, and it's just, the entire thing is a total red herring. Particularly like the 2 hours later is just a completely meaningless URAM needing some particular symbol, just no hint of Jin-Ho, and I actually think it's a great decision there. Because if they're showing the 2 hours later where Jin-Ho is rattling this whole thing off, it completely lessens the impact, right? So I think that was a great idea. Do you have anything to add about just the preamble to the actual gameplay, to the rattling off of the decks itself?
Yeah, it's fairly uneventful. Like, we really get no insight into what Jin-Ho or Pung is doing during this time. It's worth noting as well that Pung is firmly on the outs along with Jin-Ho. Like, we've seen him in the past kind of straddle the fence between working with Gura, working with Jin-Ho, or just kind of floating along doing his own thing. But here, it's, you know, the line has been drawn in the sand now.
Yeah, definitely. So I think let's just get into it. People are getting their decks situated to present to the dealers. Yoon-ji is up first, and this is, like, something like this is totally stands out as fantastic upon rewatching. When Yoon-ji presents her deck, Jin-Ho leans over and goes, "Whoa, there are red cards?" Like, he doesn't even know the existence of red cards, and the first time around, you're just counting him out. But now it's just crazy in retrospect. One thing I noticed is when they're playing their turn, they literally say open and pass in English. Are there not Korean words for those concepts?
I'm sure there are, but it's Konglish, right? It's borrowing convenient words that they've seen elsewhere and used for other things.
Fighting! Yeah.
I love that.
So I do too, for sure. I'm never sure how they determine the order, but I'm sure it's just producer discretion, which I was somewhat surprised to not see Jin-Ho last, given that they knew he had that kind of hack.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Given that, is it almost more suspenseful not putting Jin-Ho last? Because people, I think, would assume the same logic that you just said, where clearly if they were building up to Jin-Ho somehow winning, then they would put him last for maximum dramatic effect. So you, like, next level them and put him second to last just to keep the facade going.
Yeah, I think you could go either way with that, because I think by the time it gets there, where it's the core five have gone and they've all had all their cards to collude with, and no one's going to have expectations of Jinho or Pung either way. Like, if you put Pung before Jinho and he does terribly, as we see him do, then you, of course, have no expectations for Jinho. So I wouldn't have, I don't think it would have been super face up if they put him last.
Yeah, it's just a bit weird after this massive moment has just finished to see, okay, well, now Pung's going up and he's going to try and get, like, 200 or something.
Yeah, I probably would have put Jinho last if I knew that that was coming. Okay, so let's see. The Kyungran rattles off 15,500. Sungyu, out of the five personal alliances, is the low man at 128. Pung ends up tying him. And I guess let's get into the actual moment itself, that being Jinho's turn. What was it like watching this for you the first time around? Because I think this is one of the highlights of the season. I know you weren't overly enthused about it earlier, but come on.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't like leaping out of my chair or anything, but after it finished, you just kind of sat there like, yeah, that was pretty damn impressive.
I literally leapt out of my chair. This was the first moment, including Sangmin's Garnet Heist. I got up out of my chair and walked out of my room.
Yeah, there are like one or two moments each season where it's like, okay, that's, I'm not quite sure how that can ever be topped, and then somehow the next season manages to do it anyway.
I think this is only the first of many of those kind of moments that we're going to get to talk about.
Yeah, it's like how on Survivor or Big Brother, there are certain, you know, events, tribal councils, evictions, which you can watch over and over again and never get bored of them, and I feel like this is one of those moments in The Genius.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely, and it's fun. Of course, when Jinho is passing on blue cards and then opening a different blue card and doing it correctly, I know at first I thought he was just getting lucky, and then the Genius theme song dropped in, which is how you know real shit's about to go down.
Yeah, and it cuts to Kyungran saying, oh, okay, so the black card's the multiplication, and then he, like, passes on a black card when he needs a multiplication, and he just looks completely bewildered.
Yeah, it's so good. Is this the biggest moment of the season for you, or would you take the Garnet Heist over this?
It's hard to really compare it to the Garnet Heist. I think the Garnet Heist just has to take the crown there, just because there's no... It's like, that really set the stage for everything that came afterwards, right? Whereas this is certainly impressive, and in the context of the series, it really sent the message that if it's a physical game of any sort, there's always some kind of hack that you can find to break it wide open.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can ever really top episode one in that regard.
Right. If there are props, you need to be doing everything you can to figure out what the trick is, whatever the game is. Yeah. I have a question, and I have a theory more so. I think Jinho being on the outs may have been the best thing possible for him, because if he was concerned about creating a deck with different colors and different symbols and multiplication and numbers, he may not have ever even noticed that the backs of the cards were asymmetrical.
Yeah, I think he's less likely to win this game if there's not as much pressure on him to find some kind of desperation answer. At the same time, he wouldn't need it if he was like in some majority line. So I don't think it's really I don't think it's fair to compare it like that.
Okay. I don't know. I think this moment, I would probably put this above the Garnet Heist just because it's one of those things that all of them were looking at the same backs of the cards, and he was the one person who noticed, and that's what I like. I think I like it when people, one person is the one who's able to break the game and really just lock it in. Yeah. So let's see. Pung and Sungyu were both tied at 128, and Jinho decides he's going to go to the deathmatch, and he sends in Pung here. And honestly, I was surprised by that, of course, because it seemed like they were the two that were isolated by the rest of the group. But much like Kim Gura, I really got the impression that Pung was ready to go here.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think Pung just, you know, made a misjudgment in the heat of the moment, whereas Gura, I think, clearly just wanted to be out of there.
Okay, that's possible. But I still feel like, calling it off against whatever he called it off against, calling off against a seven in Indian poker is not where you want to be going when there's so much room to play left.
What do you make of Jinho picking Pung then? Because it's not the first time we've seen this from him, right? You think way back to the first episode, he has this choice of letting Junsuk win or letting Minseo win, and he's the one to really drive the nail into Junsuk there.
Yeah, to me, it at least draws some kind of parallel to an idea that I really like in Survivor and Big Brother, which is if you're in the vast minority, it's not often a bad idea to just be the only person left from your alliance. Like, that's going to give you more chances to win. So if he's being viewed as too tight with Junsuk, then go ahead and have Junsuk gone, and then he's theoretically at least a free agent and not nearly as big of a threat, and similarly here with Pung. So let's see. Pung ends up picking Yoonji, and as mentioned, they're playing Indian poker. The pot is literally five chips. And he puts in 40 more against a 7 from Yoon-ji giving every false tell in the world. So I don't know. I think he may have just psyched himself out because for some reason Jin-ho was telling him pregame, like, don't even fold against an 8 or a 7. Like, make sure you got to keep him honest, I guess. And I don't think that that's necessarily the case when you only have one life in the game.
Do you think when Jin-ho picks Peng, presumably he then wants him to lose, do you think Jin-ho was giving him false advice there?
Yeah, that is definitely something that I hadn't considered, but I don't even know if Jin-ho would be that diabolical.
Yeah, Jin-ho seems like someone who, he might recognize that he wants someone to go for the good of his own game, but he's not going to, like, try and sabotage him in the process.
Right, I think he's going to say, well, if, you know, I'll let merit decide whether or not they should be here. Yeah. Anything else on Poong or on Indian poker for now?
I don't think so. We'll have plenty more opportunities to talk about Indian poker in the future as and when it comes up.
Yeah, although I gotta say, just I'm sure I will not forget to say this in the future, but I want to say it now, early and often. The string betting that goes on in these Indian poker games is obscene. In poker, you can't. It doesn't go. Someone bets and then you call and then raise the bet. You just have to announce a raise first, so you can't get like reads off them once they know you're not folding. Yeah.
And the way that some of them do it, where it's like they slide one chip in slowly and then reach in for another chip and slide that over slowly, it's just, it's really infuriating.
I can't believe the lady dealer doesn't just fucking slap them for that. But it's like, I'm guessing a lot of these people have played in casinos before and they know the rules about string betting. It seems like no one's paying attention to them. Like, actively disregarding them. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe they just think it's a more casual environment for some reason. I don't know. Either way, one thing about Peng here, the way he goes out where he's calling off this weird, this big bet from Yoon-ji, when she is giving off the most obvious, like, familiar level one weak means strong tells in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
Like, there is a slim chance that Yoon-ji is just like this psychopathic mastermind who has been playing all of you this whole time and, you know, everything you thought you knew about human interaction is completely wrong, but realistically, you have a one there. Like, based on what you've seen of her over the past 7 weeks, there's no way that this is some like massive deliberate ruse.
Yeah. So that is the end of the game for Poong. Pretty easy victory there for Yoon-ji. I guess great play. Like, in Yoon-ji's seat, I would be wanting to give my opponent more credit than to be willing to stack off unless I'm holding anything but the nut low there.
Yeah, Poong strikes me as the type who would be quite a conservative player. So yeah, I would be thinking in that spot, well, obviously Poong is not going to be willing to call this off unless he's very confident that he's going to win, which apparently he was for reasons that remain unknown to us, but there you go.
Yeah, so that's what you get when you stack off against a 7. In most cases, I guess, unless you're playing against Kim Gura.
Yeah, I guess the idea is if he thought that he had a 10 and she was trying to bluff him off a 10 and she didn't really know how to go about doing it, so she just, like, did the most obvious thing that you can do, but even in that case, just fold and pick your battles more carefully.
Right, even if... Yeah, right, exactly. Pick a better spot. There's really no excuse, I think, to call there. Even if you think it's, like, 30% likely that you have a 10. Okay, so that is that. And just quickly, and I'll edit this out in case we find a way to fix it, but we're having slight audio issues, but hopefully that gets resolved very quickly. Or I can edit this out, or fix them and then edit this out. Okay. But if this is not edited out, that's still happening. All right, so let us get into episode 8, and it is Kong's Dilemma, and this is a really fun one. We're down to 6 people. They're going to get split into 2 teams, and each team, whoever puts in the most Kongs, these little beans, into a pot, each round gets a point. And the losing side's Kong total that they dropped is revealed. And the first team to 3 points wins, and on that winning team, the person with the most Kongs remaining will be your individual winner. This is the first reference that we get. I think this is interesting to track each season. As they're all standing around, like, the genius table in the intro segment, they for the first time, reference that the episodes have started airing now. So I think this is always interesting to see when they start to know and get to start to see their, you know, the early weeks as they still have rounds left to play.
Yeah, it means that the genius is very different from both a show like Survivor, where the entire filming process is self-contained and you only see it once it starts airing a few months down the road, and also a show like Big Brother, where everything is done live and in real time, and you have no way of tracking the perception of you or what's going on outside as the show is going on. So it's this kind of interesting... So it's in this kind of weird, interesting position where once you get down to week 7 or 8, as we are here, you start to see what happens in the early episodes, which means you know, if you made a Final Two alliance on the first day, people are going to know about that at some point while the show is actually still continuing. So it really ends up affecting the way that you have to play. And I think that's why in the first few episodes, you can tell that people are very wary of, like, privately betraying people, because they know that that's not going to remain private for long. You know, eventually it is going to come out. And if that person is still in the game with you, then that could have ramifications down the line.
Yeah, and we got a question on Twitter from Alex Lee asking, in our opinions, does it hurt the game that they know it's going to begin airing well before they're done filming?
I think in a way it does. I can see how it might add to the collegial atmosphere, where it very much feels like you're just taking a day off to go and play this game, and then you get to see it and kind of joke about it later and so on. But I think when it actually does But I think when it does end up changing the way that you have to play, it requires a really big upside to outweigh that, and I'm not sure that upside is there.
Yeah, I don't... I think in theory it would certainly be a much more interesting game if it was like Whodunit, for instance, where they're just in a hotel overnight and they play a new round each morning. And, you know, they film the whole thing, and then however long down the line the episodes film. I think the problem is when, you know, a critical aspect, at least at this point, of The Genius is that it's celebrities playing. And these are presumably people who have pretty busy schedules. And I think the way it's done, where they get together, I think, roughly once a week, maybe it's just every Friday they get together and go play The Genius or whatever. I think it's just part of the way the game works. Like, from the onset, that's been part of it. So I think it's hard to say that it's, like, bad for the game, although I do agree that it's kind of limiting. Like, of course, you can't be forming a Final Two alliance early, let alone, like, multiple Final Twos like we see people do in Survivor.
Yeah, and I think that might also be why you don't see these confessionals about how, oh, I cleverly, you know, outmaneuvered this person, because you know that they're going to see how you really feel about them before the game has ended, potentially. I think, at least in the Korean version, it is a very big part that you do have these celebrities involved, and part of that is you can't ask them to take, you know, a two-week chunk out of their lives at a time to go and film The Genius, and so you do have to break it up like this. But that doesn't mean you have to start airing it before the show has finished filming. Like, you could just do it all from, like, April to June, let's say, and then maybe it starts airing in September.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I kind of like it. I like that because, like you said, it's so unlike Survivor, where they do that. They go and film it, and then months later it airs. And also unlike Big Brother, where when it's airing, they're all in the house and thus can't see it. I kind of like that I like seeing what happens when they are able to watch the episodes before the game's done playing.
Yeah, it's difficult to see just how it ends up changing things, because firstly, it's more about what they don't do as a response to that than what they do do. So, for instance, they don't make these alliances early. They don't talk about other people behind their backs. And so it's hard to really pinpoint what's going on. Also, when it is brought up in conversation, it doesn't really lead anywhere. So it's not like, oh, you said this about me and now I'm going to do this. Or, you know, you don't see people joking about what was said 4 or 5 weeks ago. It's more just kind of, okay, it's mentioned and then everyone moves on. There's no real payoff from it.
Right, like on The Genius, and this is constant so far, at least through the first 3 seasons, is there isn't anyone like a Courtney Yates type who's just trashing people, or Corinne, who's just trashing people in confessionals. Because when you're giving those confessionals, you know, oh shit, this may air before this game is over and they could easily still be in.
Yeah, and that may just be Korean cultural factors the type of people that they cast on the show. There are lots of reasons why that may be, but it does mean that you don't have that element to the show which does seem to underpin a lot of Western reality TV.
Yeah, and I think, at least for me, and I know this probably isn't going to be the case for everyone, like, certainly if you remove that element from, like, the Real Housewives show, there's nothing to watch. But for me, I feel like it suggests that we don't need that element in all of these shows. Like, we don't need Courtney or Corinne being mean. Right. I don't know.
Right. It's good to hear people's private thoughts when it pertains to, you know, I'm meeting this person for the first time, or there's some element of the game that I figured out and I'm going to tell you what it is. Yeah, I don't think we really need to hear all of the, you know, all of like the petty insults and everything like that. It sometimes does, you know, heighten the drama of Survivor or whatever, but it's not a necessary part of the show, and I think The Genius does a good job of proving that.
For sure. And actually, I think the closest thing we get to any kind of like personal beef on The Genius is this, we just have kind of this running storyline that Yoonji and Sung-yu have been like oil and water, basically, probably because she's an Aries. I think actually this is the episode where that happens. So it is interesting, you know, as we split into these teams, they end up on the team together, where it's those two and Kyungran against Sangmin, Yuram, and Jinho here.
Yeah, but even with those two, it never takes a tone of, oh, I hate Yoonji, she's a terrible person, yeah, and so on. It's more just, we don't mix well. You know, it's very kind of, he's almost putting some of the blame on himself.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was going to say. It's the two of us are not a good combination because of me as well. It's not, oh, she's a bitch or whatever. Okay, so both teams quickly realize that the key here is going to be getting someone on the other team to help them, and Sangmin ends up coming to the conclusion that he's going to be that person for the other team.
Yeah, if the game had a more team-based incentive where, let's say, everyone on the winning team ends up winning the game or something where it was compatible with this tension where you have to leave Kong's back and choose how much you want to help the team, then you might see people play differently. It would be a much more kind of basic game theory scenario. As it is, it basically just reduces to which team can get someone from the other team to play Mole for them.
Right, because it's obviously a much easier game if you know how many Kongs the other team is going to be putting in each round, which is, but I think actually this is probably one of Sangmin's weaker rounds here, despite, you know, he it looks clever as hell, of course, not dropping any of his Kongs in, which we'll get to. But I feel like, you know, he tries to be the Mole here and then gets his spot blown up and has to go back to his own team who doesn't even trust him.
Yeah, it's hard enough to coordinate the number of Kongs your team's going to put in when you have maybe reservations about one person on your team. When one person on your team is feeding that information back to the other team, it becomes that much more difficult. And Sangmin realizes this, tries to act on it, but as you say, doesn't end up doing a very good job from what we can see.
I think this is Sangmin's second worst game performance of the season, and we haven't gotten to his worst yet, although we will be getting there.
Right, it's like Sangmin has the right idea, but ends up executing it very badly, which is a reversal of how he sometimes acts, where maybe he doesn't cotton on to the bigger picture, but is excellent at just talking to people and getting the result that he needs.
Yeah, and I mean, just Sangmin in general, of course, a very, very, very talented player, so just potentially a little off his game today. And actually, one thing, before we get into like the strategy or whatever, I thought it was important that they're keeping these Kongs in lockers in the dealer room, and they each have a key, and Jinho tried to use his key on the other people's lockers, which didn't work. But I think at this point, that's a sign that he is learning that these games can be broken. And I think that's a great impulse to have on the Genius.
Yeah, if they give you anything at all, even if it just seems to be like a minor prop, there might be some aspect to it that you haven't figured out. And if you're able to realize that while the other people haven't, then that is a massive advantage for you. I mean, he proved this in Open Pass where he single-handedly won the game by figuring that out. But also here, like, if you were able to open other people's lockers, you would just solve the game. Like, it wouldn't even be a game. And that's, I assume, why they didn't include anything like that, but it's at least worth trying. Like, you don't lose anything by giving it a go.
Right, yeah, you can't, in good conscience, I don't think, allow the opportunity for that. But I do think it was, again, just the point is, it's a good impulse to have here for Jinho.
Right. It might be an interesting thing to kind of include in the game where it's almost like the solution is hidden in plain sight. Mm-hmm. Like, you wouldn't think that anyone would dare to try opening other people's lockers.
Well, you would think, hey, if I could open them, they wouldn't be locked, right? I wouldn't have my own key. Yeah. Okay. So I actually, you know, I think it just ended up not working out that well for Sangmin, but he did have some good stuff here where Jinho, after he's been, you know, Sangmin's been spying this whole time, and Jinho comes up with the idea in like the third round and says, hey, we should have you go be a spy. And he goes, I'm not sure they'll believe me, which is really what he's already been doing it. And then also there was another good moment, and this is just kind of in the game theory stuff, if you are trying to play this double agent role, where Jinho wants to put in 8, like cumulatively, their whole team. But Sangmin has promised already that they're going to keep it under 5. And Jinho initially splits it with himself putting 4 in, and then Urim and Sangmin each putting in 2. And then Sangmin reassigns that 8 to make himself the 4, basically, to put the, you know, so 4 then will be removed because he's not going to drop any, and they will be down under 5 now.
Right. I think if you're going to betray your team, you need to not do anything suspicious in the first round, because I think you can do it more subtly so that you know, you can tip off the other team that you're putting in 8, and then if you actually put in 8 and the other team puts in 9, that looks very much like they just outthought you and outbid you, right? You know, there is a plausible alternative explanation. Whereas here, like, if Sangmin suddenly doesn't put his assigned share in and the other team ends up winning by what you can surmise, I think, is a narrow margin, then instantly klaxons start going off in your head.
Right, well, and also just the caveat that the losing team, whichever team put in the fewer Kongs, the number that they put in gets shown each round, where if you are Sangmin, and like, I was really surprised that he didn't drop any in these early rounds, just because it seems like you have to run really good to never have that get noticed by the rest of your team. Just you have to expect that it's going to get noticed, I guess is the point.
Yeah, is there any way where you can divide the Kongs so that it becomes clear which one of your team must not have put them in?
Like, yeah, I mean, if you fully trust the other person, just put them on three different numbers of Kongs, and whatever is short, that's the person who... Or I guess that kind of does... If you make it clear to the mole, like, if you don't know who the mole is and you're saying, okay, well, we're each going to be on different numbers, so we're going to know who didn't put it in, the mole can then just put in, like, one when they were supposed to put in three and make it look like the two person didn't put it in.
Right. I think a crucial element to this game in particular is the mole on one team can't win the game because they won't be on the winning team. Mm-hmm. And if they are on the winning team, then obviously they haven't done their job as the mole properly. So, you know, you can essentially keep loyalty within your team by saying, if one of us loses, we are picking whoever was responsible for that as the deathmatch opponent. So, you know, you're not getting anything for yourself by doing this.
Yeah, I think it's also just specifically with someone, with people. It was Jinho and Yuram, right, that were on that team? Yes, with Sangmin. I think those are two types of players who it's not going to cross their mind that Sangmin, even though it is Sangmin, that he might just outright betray them because, like you said, he will then be on the losing team if he does so. So I think that could be something that comes into play where even though potentially being a mole is a great idea, it's not something that's going to cross their minds in the moment.
Yeah, and even if Sangmin does do a better job at hiding it, you look at the other people on his team, Jinho is someone who does tend to play the game straight up. Like, if he can work with a team and accomplish his goals that way, then he will. And Yuram hasn't really betrayed anyone so far or shown any inclination to kind of wander off the path that's been set. So if someone does end up betraying your team, you know that it's Sangmin, right? And he can't even throw down anyone else and expect it to work.
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is it's just not in Jinho and Yuram's range, to use poker terminology, to go ahead and just start off being the mole, or to honestly just ever become the mole. So what are we thinking about this other team now, the Sungyu and Yunji and Kyungran team?
Well, they don't have anyone as blatantly wolfy as Sangmin is. So I don't think any of these three people is likely to sell out their team. But within the team, you don't have this healthy dynamic because Sungyu and Yunji just are incompatible for some reason.
Yeah. Again, she's an Aries. It's just basic astrology, Dom. This is not complicated. Yeah, and, you know, because of Sangmin's help, this team ends up doing well and eventually winning. And they got some points early. And then I think it's interesting when they have, I think they had like 17 combined Kongs left, and there were two rounds left to play, and they just needed to get one more point. Do you jam in the fourth round, or do you hold in the fourth round?
It's a tough decision, and it one that mirrors something that we see often in these death matches, where it often comes down to if you have like a 2-1 or 3-2 lead going into the last set of rounds, then you have a lot more freedom to decide when to push, and the onus is really on your opponent to make the right play, or else they just lose the game instantly.
Right, and I believe that Sangmin's team barely covered here. They barely had more Kongs left than the red team. However, it's really tough, especially when you don't know the exact Kong count on the opposite team. If you are the Sangmin team here, the blue team, I think it was, where... To try to make a cover bet while still leaving yourself some behind when you don't know their exact amount, but you know it's high, they may not even be jamming at all in the fourth round, and they may just be saying, well, we'll hold, and if they put in even three or four Kongs, it's mathematically over in the fifth round.
Yeah, the red team is up 2-1, but they have fewer Kongs left. So the decision that the blue team has to make is, do we bet enough to cover a jam by the red team? Because if we make a small bet and the red team shoves, then it's over. So we almost have to try and cover that bet, but we don't have a large enough reserve of Kongs if we do that to make that a safe play in all circumstances.
Right. So I think when you are the team that is up 2-1 and has the fewer Kongs, I'm really into the idea of just jamming in the fourth round, because I really think any three people left in that situation when they're down and they're facing what may be a jam and may not be a jam, I think they're going to have an easy time talking themselves into not covering in the fourth round.
Yeah, because for the blue team here, if they might make a small bet on the grounds that, well, if the red team puts in zero, then we can win this round, and then in the fifth round, we can still have more Kongs than them. It's hard for them to do that here because, as far as I can remember, they only covered by two or three Kongs.
Yeah.
So they might make such a small bet that the red team might out-level them, make what's still a small bet but larger than their bet, and risk winning the game on the spot again. Okay, so I think you can break it down into basically four separate outcomes. The first is, if you think about what happens if the red team shoves. So the red team shoves and the blue team makes a small bet, then the red team wins because they're up 3-1. If the red team shoves and the blue team shoves, then the blue team wins. It's tied at 2-2, and now they have Kongs in reserve for the fifth round, and they win that. Where I think it gets interesting is if the red team makes a non-zero bet that's smaller than a shove. So if the red team makes a small bet and the blue team shoves, then the red team wins, because the blue team, assuming the red team's bet is smaller than the difference, because the blue team shoves, they win this point, but now they don't have any Kongs in reserve for round five, and the red team wins. And if the red team makes a small bet and the blue team makes a small bet, then the blue team wins if their bet is bigger, unless it's bigger than the difference, in which case the red team, again, would still have more Kongs in reserve for round five. So I think for the red team, by shoving, they reduce it to a very simple game for the blue team, where the blue team can basically flip a coin, and if they make the right call, then they win, and if they don't make the right call, then they lose. Whereas if they make a small bet, then the blue team, there's one outcome if they shove where the red team just wins automatically. And if the blue team makes a small bet, then their small bet still has to be of the right size to not make it a locked up game going into round five.
Yeah.
So my instinct is making a small bet is the best play here for the red team, because if you think about it, there's basically no reason for them to make a zero bet, because they're still going to be outmatched going into round five, but they have no chance of winning round four and locking it up right away. So I think the red team has to make a small bet, at which point the blue team also has to make a small bet, but they have to calibrate it so that it's off the right sides, and at that point it just becomes a guessing game.
I really do think you're right. I think, and that was really well put. And the other thing that I think is interesting is when we say shoving, or, you know, just holding, I think when it's round four, one would imagine that no team is literally going to shove completely all in because, or generally speaking, even though we see, I believe, minus Sung Yu holding it back, that was their plan. So maybe this is a bad point, but I would think that they would at least want to hold at least one for the final round in case the other team shoves, which then means that if everyone's should be holding one, then you should start holding two and so forth. So I think it is like an interesting kind of Nash equilibrium problem to figure out.
Yeah, and the individual component of the game also adds another dimension to it, because let's say you've decided that the best play for your team is to make a bet, let's say within the range of 5 to 7 Kongs or whatever it happens to be. You might think, well, okay, I can hold one or two Kongs back and our bet can still be in that range, at which point I would have more Kongs than my teammates and maybe be the individual winner. That obviously gets thrown out of kilter if everyone applies the same logic and everyone right. holds a Kong back, at which point, you know, your bet is the wrong size and so on. So even if you can come up with the best way to outthink the other team, there's still that other aspect to it that you have to work through.
Yeah, and I love this game, and I think this is probably my favorite game of Season 1, certainly high on the list of my favorite games that we've ever seen on The Genius. And I think let's get into Sung Yu deciding to hold this one back, because this really comes down to when they're in this position, they all agree to go all in. I actually, to get right into it, I like the idea of holding one behind. First of all, you can sell it as, well, hey, if they make the cover bet, we at least have one left over. And you can also, I think, defend very nicely against someone else getting greedy and keeping one behind. And worst case scenario often in leaving one behind is that your teammates are just mad at you.
Right. And in theory, that shouldn't matter beyond the scope of that one decision, because if your team wins, then one of them isn't picking someone for the deathmatch. So even if they are mad at you, there's not much they can do about it. And if your team loses, then presumably they have bigger problems than you holding one Kong back, which shouldn't really affect the outcome at all.
Yeah, and plus you will then not be I guess you would probably be a high likely target to get picked, but I think it's more likely in this context, and as they found themselves in the fourth round here, I'm a fan of keeping one Kong back here, just because when your team wins, you are often going to be the sole winner.
Yeah, and for Sung Yu, who has this problem with Yunji, where she doesn't come across as someone who's like overtly scheming. You saw in the horse race where she just lied for no apparent reason and messed things up for her team. But beyond that, she doesn't strike you as someone who is really going to be plunging the knife in your back if you give her the opportunity. But even so, you can understand his desire to be the sole winner and not put that in jeopardy at all.
Right. I think their concern was, and people would argue, well, hey, if all you really care about is getting the immunity this round, you might as well give it to the other people on your team too. And I think just the keeping the one back defends against someone else doing that, which is huge. And then also as he goes on to point out, like, yeah, he could have easily done that. I don't think he was thinking that either of them was going to keep one back, in all honesty. But like you said, he's not gotten along well with Yunji whatsoever, and Kyungrang just picked him for has already picked him for an elimination one time. So I think this is totally defensible here on Sungyu's part. Okay, so Jinho and Yuram are tied for the fewest Kongs on the losing team. Sungyu selects Yuram as the losing candidate, and now he has to give out the token of life to whoever he wants. And Yunji offers him 7 garnets for the token of life, but he instead gives it to Jinho for free. Again, we see that he does not seem to care for Yunji too much. And I also think, at least he said, that he wanted Yuram to pick Sangmin here as her opponent, and he thought that that would be more likely if Jinho was not on the table. Which makes very little sense, by the way, because you'd think she would, if she's going to pick someone, she'd probably pick someone that she thought she could beat. So keep Jinho in there as a bigger threat that potentially is more threatening than Sangmin, right?
Right. I think the big takeaway here is this is where the Sangmin-Sungyu relationship kind of ruptures to the greatest degree that it has so far. So you know that when your darling Hubei is begging for you to go to the death match and trying to make that happen, you have messed up somewhere. And I think, going back to what we said earlier, this is Sangmin's biggest misstep so far in the season.
Yeah, although we will see this get quickly repaired. I believe, starting at the Expression Auction, which is the next episode, they were pretty much inseparable. But yeah, so I guess let's get into this death match. And this is a stupid death match again, just to put it bluntly. This is the image game, where it's essentially who can get the most cooperation and get the people cooperating with them to sit next to them. And that's essentially who's going to win. And in this case, Sungyu, for whatever reason, after going after Yunji and talking about how much he doesn't like her, decides that he wants to be nice to her now. And Sangmin wants to help out with that as well. And Jinho eventually, winds up trying to switch seats to help Yuram, but it is not in time. And there's really nothing Yuram can do because Yunji has Sangmin and Sungyu splitting their little dice, matching one matching it and one putting one on what they know to be incorrect. So there's really no way around that. So not the finest death match. So any parting thoughts on Yuram before we move on?
Yeah, not really. She seemed nice enough, but didn't end up affecting most of the games in any great way.
Yeah. Pretty cool to be a professional pool player, though. I would pay a lot of money. Like, I've often thought to myself, I would probably pay $500 if I could just be nasty at pool.
Yeah, there are lots of things I'm bad at. Pool is something that I am just completely, actively hopeless at. Like, there's no way I could come close to, taking a set off anybody. It would be completely awful.
Okay. All right. So let us move on now to episode 9. It is the Expression Auction. I love this game. And I think it's worth talking just about the game itself before we get into how it actually went down. So everyone is going to get cubes numbered 1 through 10, and they're going to use these cubes to bid on separate numbers and signs to complete an expression. And the goal of the game is to make an expression that equals 10. And any cubes that are used for bidding are discarded, even if they got raised. Like, you can't then pull it back. Any cube that you put out there at any point to offer a bid gets taken, win or lose. And the tiles are going to be presented in a predetermined order that is made public before the game starts. And I wish we're not going to get into it to the extent that we're going to examine the order that they got distributed and try to crack it like that. But I think that it is worth at least noting that the players themselves had the opportunity to do that. And the first thing I love is that there's a 5-second shot clock, basically, when they're bidding. And I think when the cubes are getting taken, even if you lost the bid, I think it's pretty much always best to just completely slow roll and wait for it to get to 1 second, right? To see if anyone else jumps in so you can potentially save a cube.
Yeah, that's right. And we see this with Jinho's plan to help Kyungran by telling Sungyu that he's going to outbid her at the last minute and then refraining from doing so, like playing on that expectation that that's what everyone is going to do. Mm. I think that's an unavoidable part of having a shot clock where, like, if you make it 10 seconds instead, then, okay, people just wait for 8 seconds and then try and build on it. So I like having the shot clock in place, but it does mean that this very quickly and obviously becomes the right thing to do.
Right, yeah. But, I mean, 5 seconds is a fair enough amount of time to give people some time to think, but it's not getting annoying every time, like, counting down from 10 would. Yeah. So let's see. You have to use every tile that you purchase, which is crucial. And you can't use numbers back-to-back, as in you can't buy a 1 and then buy a 6 later and use that as 16. And anyone who fails to complete an expression is the automatic loser. And the winner is the person who gets 10 first or comes closest to 10 by the end of the game.
Yeah, you also can't trade tiles, so you can't take a tile and then conspire with someone else so that you can both make 10 or anything like that. And I think, crucially, one of the most important rules is if you match somebody's bid, then the auction is over, no one gets that tile, and both of those cubes are taken out of play, which really means, I think, that the best strategy for the game is a defensive one, because even though it might be hard to make 10 yourself, it's quite easy to stop other people from getting the tiles that they need to make 10.
Well, if you're doing that, if you're trying to be the lone defender, aren't you going to eventually run out of cubes before everyone else, you know, they still have all of theirs left to bid with? And you're just going to not have a complete expression?
Well, I think in that case, the goal would be complete an expression, not necessarily a good one. So you might end up with like 5 or 6, but at least you have something that's eligible. And then spend the rest of your cubes trying to outbid someone else or match someone else's bid so that someone else that you're working with can swoop in and take what they need.
Okay. I don't disagree at all. I think matching, like the caveat that a matching bid just completely just ends that auction right then and there is massive as far as how to approach the game. I think the number one thing for me is, since we can't trade or discard or use them back-to-back, given the way that these tiles are being distributed, I think we get the numbers 1 through 6 right away, and then we only get 7, 8, and 9 way down the line, and everything else, I think, comes in some individual signs, but then also number sign pairs where you can, those are the only other ways to get numbers, and you need to have one fewer symbol than you have numbers to complete a legal expression. Point being, I think you have to get one of those early numbers to put yourself in a chance, just because by the time the later single numbers come up, there are plenty of ways someone could have already made 10.
Yeah, and it also means that going for a symbol early is quite a risky proposition, because as we see with Sangmin, he ends up bidding on a symbol to try and raise the price of someone else, gets stuck with a symbol himself, and now he needs to pick up just an isolated number, because he already has a symbol. If he picks up a number and a symbol, then he still has 2 symbols, so that's one more than he needs. So he has to wait until that last set of auctions to maybe pick up one of the straggling numbers that's left over, which isn't something that you can rely on at all.
The more I think about it, there should have been no one even placing a bid on the individual symbols, because it would require you, like, it just, when you need one more number than symbol, it makes you get 2 more numbers, and that you cannot get 2 numbers at a time. You can only get them with another symbol or individually way down the line.
Right, and you have to imagine that someone is going to assemble 10, or at least run the risk of assembling 10 before the auction even gets to the stage where you can pick up another number by itself.
Right. That was, I think, the big concern for Jinho was, I need to get a single number immediately, because these are just going to start coming out with symbols assigned to them as well, and I'm going to be out of luck.
Yeah, so if everyone is planning to stay away from the symbols, then maybe one strategy you could use is, if you're able to pick up 2 of the early numbers, then you can bid on a symbol, safe in the knowledge that no one is really going to want to outbid you and risk getting stuck with a symbol themselves, because if they bid on it, you can just let them have it, and then they're stuck with it, and you can just go for the next symbol. You might not end up with a high number, but as long as you can complete an expression, you can ensure that somebody else gets stuck, unable to make one.
Yeah, I think going for 2 of the first 6 numbers is risky. Like, yeah, you can probably make an expression, which means you likely won't finish last, but I don't think they're going to let you make an expression anywhere near 10. They'll just keep blocking your bids. And if they block all of them, you cannot make an expression unless you get to round 23, where the only remaining lone symbol is left. And I think that's pretty optimistic to think it's going to go that long.
Yeah. The hope would be, though, that someone else won't be able to make an expression. And so even if yours ends up being like 4 or something, which is not impressive, then at least you're on the board. And by completing your expression early, you're not fighting with other people for the tiles that they might need, in which case you're unlikely to be picked for the deathmatch because you weren't responsible for making sure that someone ended up losing.
That's true. And just quickly, I know I said earlier that we didn't have it all written down and that would be too much. We did pause and look it up, and that's how I knew it was round 23. But anyway, so let us get into things. And it's funny at first where Sangmin doesn't understand that it stops when someone makes 10, and he thinks that they can all make 10 and just agree to not go after each other's numbers. That was really funny.
Yeah, he does say at the start, why does this game seem so easy to me? The first of many possibly hubristic statements that he's going to make during this episode.
Yeah, and I also like that Sung Yu starts copying down the order that they're going to distribute all the tiles in, and they're like, why are you writing it down? I want to write it down. You can just look at it.
Yeah. The student realized that. And Sung-yu also leaves his gun pouch there again, and Sang-min has to pick it up again and give it back to him, which obviously after Sang-min's antics in the first episode with Jin-ho's gun, it causes some concern with Sung-yu.
Yeah, he checks to make sure. And Sung-yu's like, I didn't take any, don't worry. Yeah, and I have a point just before we get into this that I want to bring up about just auction games in general. And it's because I play in an auction fantasy football league, and it's a very popular format for drafting fantasy football players. And so it's thus analyzed a lot, and all the big names talk about it. And I listen to a podcast, and Nate Ravitz makes a great point that in fantasy auctions, and I think it's totally the case in these genius auctions as well, when people look back on what they did wrong in the auction, it almost always is, I wish I had spent more on the most valuable stuff early on. You know what I mean? Like, waiting, yes, you can get your choice. You're going to have more money to work with, but you're not going to have nearly what you need. Like, it's going to be so much harder to win.
Yeah, I guess that's the argument that if you show your cards like that early, then everyone else knows what you're going for later on, so they can fight you for it, and it's that much easier to fight you for it because you spent all of your good cubes going for the important stuff. And also, in an auction like this one, where you need two very specific things, if everybody else knows what you need, then it's easier to plan around that and be in a position to take it away from you later on. At the same time, if you're able to lock up half of your ideal combination early, then that puts the impetus on everyone else to react to it and to, you know, start working on their expressions before you get to that point. And it also means that if their plan is to just wait it out and see what happens, then if everybody else is doing the same thing, then not only are they trying to block you from getting what you need, but they're also competing with each other for stuff which they maybe don't even need at all.
Right. That's what I think is when you get these powerful tiles, it would require your opponents playing really, really well, playing nearly flawless defense to prevent Sung-yu from getting at least one of the, you know, getting one of those three things that can win it for him. Like, when you do have the one, that gives you so much flexibility. And, like, and I also think there is something to it where when you've put out a couple of, you know, you've burned a couple of your cubes on the early numbers, make it worth your own while. Like, don't just have given those away for free. Like, it's worth upping it by one.
I also wonder if, hypothetically, let's say you have the one tile and there's a set later on which is 9 and a multiplication sign, that might not be good enough to win, but you can essentially say, look, I'm going to go all out to get that tile and make my expression equal 9, and if you block me for that, then if I end up losing, you're going to the death match.
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of ultimatum is a really valuable tool in this game because it's so often going to come down to one person either blocking you or not blocking you or bidding at the wrong time or something like that.
Yeah, well, at least at this point, that's what it's going to come down to. They do know that there is a special auction, which I think they have to assign some weight to, but I don't think they understand at this point how powerful it is. Yeah, so one other thing that I wanted to bring up is another nice piece of strategy that I noticed is Kyungran was in a spot early on where she'd already used up some of her lower cubes, and it looked like it was just Jin-ho and Yoon-ji going back and forth, bidding quite lowly, and Kyungran's lowest number left was 5, and while she knew that she was going to bid on it at some point, she didn't just throw her 5 cube out there, she let them use up their lower cubes, which I thought was really good, before eventually bidding 5. Yeah, you might as well let them get rid of their 4s, 3s, 2s, 1s.
Yeah, so let's start with this first round. We said that Sung-yu makes a big push for the one tile. He has to fight Kyungran for it, ends up using his 1 cube, his 3 cube, and his 5 cube. Obviously, the 1 cube not going to do very much, but, you know, burning some of those smaller and middle-ranked cubes, it might be an issue down the line. However, Sung-yu, as we say, later reveals that he's perfectly willing to burn a lot of cubes early to get that one tile because it gives him so many options later on. So the number 2 tile comes up now. There's a fair bit of competition for that as well because Yoon-ji bids for it. Jin-ho decides that he's going to seek vengeance for Pung and Yoram and fight with Yoon-ji for the 2 tile. So that raises the price. Kyungran throws a bid in there as well, and then Yoon-ji decides she really wants a tile here. So she uses her 6 cube to secure the 2. Then Kyungran wins the 3 without much competition. Sang-min wins the 4. Not really a fight over that one. And now we get to the 5 and the 6. Now, these are the last 2 tiles before the run of symbols comes up. And this is actually where it kind of gets interesting because the 5 gets blocked by Sung-yu when Jin-ho tries to bid on it. And then the 6 gets blocked when both Yoon-ji and Kyungran use their 1 tile. So the 6 gets taken out of play without anyone really having to sacrifice anything.
Yeah.
And suddenly we're at this first run of symbols and Jin-ho doesn't have a tile yet.
Yeah, certainly, you know, we've already talked about the importance of getting a tile early, not where you want to be with Jinho. I think there are only, like, two or three more spots to get an individual tile, and he needs to get one of them to even have a chance.
Right, there's the 6 and the 7 at 11 and 12, and then the very last tile is the 10 at spot 24. You don't know what the special option is going to be, so maybe that changes things, but you can't even rely on getting to 24, so unless you can get one of those tiles, then you might be in trouble here. Now, we get to this this run of symbols, and the plus comes up, and Sangmin decides, well, okay, this is going to be a popular tile, so I'm going to try and raise the price on this. But it turns out no one actually wants it, and Sangmin gets landed with the plus tile. And now he's kind of in the same position that Jinho's in, where he needs to get just an isolated number tile, and there are only three spots left to do that, and the only two reliable spots left are the two that are coming up at 11 and 12.
Right, and the problem with those are that one of them is the number 6, which no one will let him get, because that would give him an even 10, so it has to be that 7.
Yeah, and the other problem is he knows that he will have to fight tooth and nail with Jinho to get one of those tiles, because no one's going to let him get the 6, and the 7 could easily be his last chance to even complete an expression. So not only will he be fighting with Jinho to stay alive, he'll be fighting with everyone else to even have a hope of getting a tile.
Right, and when he's sitting here now with this 4 and the plus sign and the 6 comes up, I at first thought maybe he should just throw the 10 out there and make someone be a hero, but someone will 100% of the time match that, and then he's just down his 10 cube, and Jinho's got that other, you know, the next most important tile is coming up next, and he now no longer can just jam his 10 cube and ensure that he makes that he completes an expression, and now Jinho has the ability to do that. So I definitely don't like forcing someone to be a hero on the 6, and I think when the 7 comes up, though, I do like Sangmin just slamming his 10 cube, and if someone blocks it, someone blocks it, and the game is over.
Yeah, is there anything that Sangmin can do there, do you think?
No, other than I don't even know if you should even be bidding on the 6, just because no one's going to let him get it, so he's just wasting his cubes. So on the 7, just immediately throw your 10 out there. So you save all of your lower cubes, and if someone blocks it, then there's nothing more you can do, and you're essentially out of the game, and you can, at that point, focus your priorities on just helping someone else win to get the second token of life.
So now we do get to the 6 and the 7. Eunji actually bids for the 6, and Sangmin here, obviously, he would like to get the 6 and just end the game as a sole winner, but he knows that no one's going to let him do that. So instead of burning his more valuable cubes, he decides to just match Yunji's bid, take the 6 out of play altogether without really sacrificing anything himself, and also ensuring that Jinho now has to fight for the 7 tile.
Yeah, I think when Yunji only has her one other number, there's merit in just letting her take it here. Kind of like Sangmin got stuck with the plus, she could get stuck with just a second number and no symbol to connect them, and all we have left after this point is just the plus sign. All the other individual symbols are gone, so she cannot complete an expression unless she gets there.
Well, more so than that, I think that's actually the obvious and the right play to make. I think Sangmin makes a not necessarily an outright mistake, because maybe someone is going to want the plus sign, but he at least makes an error of judgment by picking up the plus sign here, and I think he makes just an outright mistake by then not sticking Yunji with the 6 when she in turn maybe also makes a mistake by going for it.
What do you think about the idea of kind of like what I would have wanted to see out of Cochrane when Malcolm bid $20 on that beer, then just immediately say no one raise, let him get underneath the minimum or the maximum, and now he cannot get that whatever the advantage we know is coming. Do you think that in this kind of context of the genius with these players and in Korea, there's merit when Yunji puts out to her bid for the 6 to just shout, let her take it, don't anyone raise, because then she's going to be screwed? Or is that out of line in this context?
I don't think it's out of line. Well, obviously we don't think it's out of line. It might be, in that context, considered a dishonorable thing to do. It's also risky in the context of the game, where if Yunji ends up in the deathmatch, then suddenly the person who shouted to everybody that they should let her go there becomes an appealing person to pick.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, and we see this come up with the 7 tile as well, where Jinho instantly uses his 10 because he absolutely needs to get a number here. Because if he doesn't, then the game won't end immediately because you still have the rest of the auction to go through, but Jinho essentially can't complete an expression anymore. And so someone else could just use their 10 and ensure that Jinho loses, but they know that if they do that, not only is that not seen as kosher, But also, Jinho, if he goes to the deathmatch, is just going to pick them. And he actually makes that very clear. Like, if you stop me from completing the expression, that is going to come back to bite you.
Right, and this is what I love about the genius. And this is what I mean when I say I think the approach has to be not how do I win the main match, but how do I stay out of the deathmatch. This is a very good way to ensure that you don't outright lose the deathmatch, just piling your 10, or, you know, matching his 10, and ensuring that Jinho will be one of the losers. At the same time, Jinho could easily get given the token of life, or he could easily pick you if you're not immune. So it doesn't do you a whole lot of good in overall, because it almost probably increases your chances of going to the deathmatch by freezing Jinho out here. Yeah, so one other thing from this episode, before we keep moving on in it, that I wanted to bring up is we get a lot of references this week to Jinho always finishing second in StarCraft to that guy Boxer. And that was one of the bigger plot points for the season for me. It was whether or not Jinho, especially as we got closer to the finals, seeing whether or not he'd get exactly second place again. And I couldn't tell, and I loved that I couldn't tell the whole time, that it certainly didn't seem like it gave it away that he was going to end up winning. I think in retrospect, people can draw that conclusion. But in real time, even when it was in the finals, I thought whether or not Jinho would get second, I think that's one of the best storylines. And actually, just in watching a couple other things that Bum Diddlyumptious, who, by the way, shout out to Bum Diddlyumptious if we haven't already done that. Great, the quirky dude of the genius. Loving that guy. Just having seen... Oh, go ahead.
I believe she's female, but...
Oh, sure.
Either way, yeah. Shout out to whoever that happens to be.
Yeah, point being, he or she also does other shows. Then Jinho is on other shows, so I've just checked those out. And Jinho always finishing second that's like the story of his life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it comes up in every single thing that he does. They always make fun of him for losing to this guy you won. Yeah. So we get to the special auction. Let's get into this. And they are bidding in garnets for an 11 cube. And Dom, I know that in the heat of the moment, and certainly without knowledge of how the endgame rules of the genius game itself works, I'd be pretty terrified of bidding, you know, aggressively here. But knowing what I know now, 7 garnets for this 11 cube is the steal of the century. Like, people should be breaking the bank here, because the 11 cube essentially becomes when it's worth basically 2 tokens of life, because if you have it, someone will always be willing to just keep blocking until it comes into play and wins you the game. I think 7 cubes is just an absolute steal. Or 7 garnets for the 11 cube is just an absolute steal.
Yeah, especially considering that the winner of this game gets 10 garnets. So, you know, if you're paying 7 garnets to get this 11 cube, if you manage to win the game, which you should do almost all of the time if you win it, then you're basically getting your investment back and winning immunity and getting immunity for someone else that you might want to keep around.
Yeah, and turning a profit if all it cost you was 7 garnets. Like, yeah. I don't remember their exact garnets here. I would be willing to bid at least 2/3 of my garnets, knowing what I know about how things work, which, again, is not the knowledge that they had. But, no, that's a great point. When you're winning 10 garnets, it's even less excusable to not just essentially be going all in here. And especially when you're Sung Yu, where you know that coming up not in the distant future is a set of tiles that will win you the game if no one makes 10 before that point. This 11 cube is just 2 tokens of life, and you're just paying however many garnets it takes. Yeah. So actually, the only thing that could really get in the way of that, we referenced it a little earlier, was Jinho essentially is trying to convince Sung Yu that he's being helpful for him and burning all the girls' cubes until the 10 division comes up. But then when a set of tiles comes up that would give Kyungran the win, as we talked about, you know, he tells Sung Yu he's going to just slow roll it and wait for the last second. And then he pump fakes and doesn't even raise his hand. But Sung Yu gets in on time and stops Kyungran from just winning on the spot. And then the 10 division sign rolls around, and that is the end of the game. And Sung Yu plops out that 11 cube, and that's it.
Yeah. Now, when it was revealed that the special prize would be an 11 cube, you would think, well, okay, that just seems blatantly overpowering, because anyone who has that can just win the game on the spot when their desired tiles come up. I think one thing to recognize in the genius is that they're going to have people who are thinking through all of these games and making sure that there's no, like, one obvious way to just shut it down like that. And so why would they put in something which seems to be so obviously game-breaking? And the thing that I missed, and this is like a recurring theme where there's some obvious angle to the game that I just don't get, and it always makes me feel completely stupid, but you can actually outmaneuver the 11 cube by, if you and I are working together and I have a 5 cube left, let's say, and you also have a 5 cube, I can bid 5. You can instantly come back with your own bid of 5, and then that tile is taken out of play, and the person with the 11 cube doesn't get to jump in and secure it for themselves. So if you're quick on the ball like that, then you can pinpoint which tile that person's looking for and guarantee that that tile won't get to them.
That is a great... That's a great kind of hack for the game, and it actually really, when Sungyu, you know, the 10 division rolls around and everyone just kind of conceded the game, Sungyu hems and haws like, oh, who would ever want that? And if two people just both throw out a 3 cube or whatever, it's gone.
Right, and that's why I think Sungyu, who played this game very well, I would argue. I mean, he, I think, outmaneuvered certainly Sangmin and Jinho and most of the others as well, but this is like the one chance where if someone had been thinking about it, they could have just taken it away from him.
Yeah, that's something that probably, I can't believe, didn't come up on a break. Like, whenever a winning tile comes out, we need to put out our lowest matching numbers to just take it off the board.
Especially since there was a break every 6 rounds, I believe.
Yeah.
Is that right? Like, after every column. So there was a point before the 10 and the division sign came up where there was a break and someone could have, like, gone to another player and made that arrangement with them.
Yeah, that would have been great. That's a great find, Dom.
Yeah, it's coming back to what I said at the beginning, where this specific game seems very defensive in that if you're working with someone else, you can block someone from getting a certain tile, and therefore, if you can coordinate it so that, let's say, you both have 3, 4, 5, and 6 left, like you can maybe burn your 7 to 10 cubes early to get what you want in the first few rounds, and then later on, you can agree to match cubes with another player and just take all the relevant tiles out of play.
I love it. That's great. I can't wait. I hope they, in some form, maybe if they do an American Genius, someone who winds up on the American Genius hears that and they play this game and it all comes full circle. Yeah. Very strong work here by Sungyu this game. I would probably say the highlight of his season as far as actually performing.
Right. And that hack for the game, as you described it, I think it's more of like a counter hack in that it stops the game from being just busted wide open by the 11 cube. But however you want to characterize it, I think that's the kind of thing which makes me hesitate about describing like Jinho or Sangmin or Sungyu as like these top tier players, where I think someone who has the kind of like mental acuity to really meet the title of the genius should be able to pick up on that and act on it. And I think there is, not to give any spoilers, but I think there are players in later seasons who would be able to realize that.
I think there's one player in one later season who would come up with that on the spot. I don't think there's anyone else. I think there's one person who comes up with that. Anyway, so let's see. We are playing now in the death match. It is Sangmin and Jinho tied for last, but Sungyu naturally puts Jinho in and then gives Sangmin the immunity in exchange for, you know, his help during the game and then also a few garnets. So Jinho picks Yoon-ji to be his opponent, and we're going to play Indian poker. And I know we've given the death matches a hard time over the course of season one, and they do get a lot better. This might be the stupidest of them all. This is literally just popular vote, where we're playing Indian poker, but this time they get assistance from the other people. Like, the panel gets to give them information about how to make their decisions. And when Jinho knows that Sangmin and Sungyu are going to give him the correct information every single time, he just needs to pick whichever, you know, make his decision based on whatever the majority of the advice decisions are, and he will never lose. That's the end of the game. Like, there's nothing Yoon-ji can ever really do about it here.
Right. The one way to maybe, outthink the game if you're the one person trying to give help to one of the players is, if the other two are following any kind of consistent pattern, then you can work around that if you're able to act last. Which I don't know if she is, but there didn't seem to be any formal process. It was just, you know, they wrote their answers on a pad or something. So let's say Sangmin and Sungyu are both voting for the same answer. Then Kyungran can just vote for the other answer, and it's clear that the one answer that she didn't pick is the right one. Or alternatively, if you know they're both voting for the same one, if the right answer is the one that they're going with, you can also vote for that, and then it's 3-0. So either way, it's clear what her vote must have been. And equally, if you know that the two of them are splitting their votes every single time, then you can also pile on whichever one of those is the right answer, and then the minority answer is the right one. The problem is if they cotton onto that and just do their votes randomly, in the sense that sometimes they go 2-0 and sometimes they split it 1-1, then there's no way that you can get around that, I don't believe.
Right. It would take some cartoon level villainy to figure to not win this game, to not, if you're trying to mess up Yunji's decisions, if you're just mixing up your decisions, you can just be flipping coins about which one you pick. There's nothing Kyungran can do. Yeah, like sometimes go 2-0, sometimes split 1-1 between the two wrong answers, sometimes split 1-1 between one right, one wrong, sometimes pile two onto the right answer. You know, probably not that last one if you're trying to fuck her up, but you know what I mean. This is just there's no way Yunji's coming out of this, is the point. So that is it. Any parting thoughts on Yunji?
Yeah, not really. She's someone who we haven't spoken about too much. She did have one fantastic quote this episode, though, where Sangmin says early on, "Why does this game seem so easy to me?" And she replies, "Isn't it because you've been to a lot of bankruptcy auctions?" Which is just like the perfect anger.
Yeah. And one other thing I wanted to bring up, just before we move on, about just Final Five and the genius in general, I think it's interesting to note the difference between being the one person between two pairs in this kind of situation, because in Survivor, that's often quite enviable because it's hard for you to be the one who's getting voted out when both sides are trying to get your loyalty to get the majority. But here, when you think about the way the genius works, assuming the game just comes away with a sole winner, which it almost always will at Final Five, they're going to give the token of life, the extra one that they get for winning, to their partner, and they're going to pick somebody, like whoever the deathmatch candidate is, among the other two people, if it's not you, is going to pick you. They're not going to pick their partner. So unless you win the game outright, it seems like you're almost always going to be in the deathmatch.
Yeah, in Survivor, whichever group has a majority usually has the power to decide who goes home. And that's why being the swing vote is so valuable, if you can engineer that, because you're going to be in the majority no matter what.
Right.
But in the genius, it's kind of like this self-correcting mechanism where the person in the minority who ends up going to the deathmatch gets to have the power to decide who goes with them. And so that kind of flips that on its head, where if you're the swing vote, now whichever pair loses, one member of that pair is going to the deathmatch, and of the winning pair, well, someone's going to win, and they're just going to give the token of life to their ally, at which point you're the only person not ally to the person who's going to the deathmatch, if that makes sense.
Right, exactly. Where I guess what it comes down to is that at Final Five, no one's working in teams of more than two, and this is the first and only point that an alliance of two can be completely protected by the token of life. Yeah. So let's move on now to the Final Four. And we are playing, I like that at Final Four now, and not just in this season, but of course because of the way the game works, everyone is essentially acting on their own accord from Final Four all the way through the end of the final. So I always like that. And because we're down to so few people, this week we are going to be playing in partners. Each contestant is going to get to pick their own partner. And I was really hoping, because we see them all like on the phones with their partner and everything, and Jinho's talking about how he's bringing one of his gamer friends, and I thought for sure it would be that guy who keeps always beating him, because I really want to see this dude, but no such luck. He just brings his other gamer friend.
Yeah, it's a shame that we don't get to see that. What we do get to see is a lot of hilarious interactions between the contestants and people in their lives who really should be on the genius as well, judging by how some of them act.
Yeah, Sungyu ends up bringing his boss here, the CEO of his record company. And by the way, CEO, everyone refers to him as like CEO Lee, and later on in future seasons, like lawyer is essentially, it seems like lawyer and CEO are also of like doctor status in Korea, where that's like an official title instead of mister.
Yeah, it like becomes part of your name almost.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, Sungyu, I question the wisdom of bringing anyone who's your boss just because of the power imbalance there. But even beyond that, Sungyu's boss clearly doesn't give a fuck what he thinks about anything. Like, he just plays by his own rules.
I thought it was funny the whole time Sungyu's just asking his boss questions about how he ranks in his boss's esteem compared to the other members of Infinite.
Yeah, and later on, when they're trapped in their rooms and their partners are out there playing the horse race, Sungyu is like shouting things at his boss, and his boss is just like, Sungyu, shut up. Who cares? Let me do it.
I love also that Sungyu the whole time just calls him, boss, boss, come here, boss. Like, yeah, I love that. And I actually also love that when he's on the phone trying to get the boss to come play, he's telling him about the other contestants, and he says, Kyungran is the scariest person alive apart from my father. That's my favorite line of season one. All right, so...
And Sungyu offers a lot of lines that would be in competition for that title, but yeah, that has to be up there.
Yeah, my favorite scene of season one is coming up in this episode. So Kyungran brings one of her friends who's an entrepreneur and an English tutor, and Sangmin actually hilariously struggles to speak English to him. So it looks like we will not be getting a Sangmin retrospective anytime soon.
Yeah, unless either of us happens to learn Korean, which I don't think is happening anytime soon.
I don't think that's going to happen, although if Bum Diddley-Up just retires and seasons, like, 4 through 10 run, I might actually have to learn Korean.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, even if we did learn Korean, it's not like our listeners would learn Korean, so it wouldn't really be worthwhile for anyone. Okay. And speaking of Sangmin, he ends up bringing the star of this episode, Haha. And actually, I think Haha did such a good job this week that I think there's a player in season two that because they saw that like the haha type could do well in this environment, I think it may have influenced someone they cast in season two.
Yeah, and there was actually a TV spin-off of another show featuring that player from season two along with haha.
Yeah.
And, you know, don't be surprised if in, you know, a few weeks you end up with like a 6-hour long podcast about that because, you know, the two of them are fantastic.
Yeah. So we are going to be playing the Confined Scamming Horse Race, and this is the same as the other horse race, except now the genius players themselves are going to be in their own isolated rooms, and their partners are going to be doing all of the information gathering and betting and so on. And it is worth noting that we have three, you know, everyone's going to get one hit to start, and then we have three additional hints for a base price of 3 garnets, and it goes up by 1 each time a hint is purchased. So the game begins, and Sung-Yu gives his boss 7 garnets to go just immediately buy the first 2 hints. I love this play, because the garnet count at this point is Sung-Yu has 24, Jin-Ho has 19, and then Sangmin and Kyung-Ran both have 7. So if you take the 3 and 4 garnet clues, it's pretty unlikely that Sangmin or Kyung-Ran is going to spend 5 of their 7 garnets on one of these clues.
Yeah, so one way to leverage the advantage that you have in garnets is to spend them on things and actually use them to directly buy advantages in the game. And the other way to exploit it is to just make sure that no one else has a chance to use theirs. Mm-hmm. So if you can get in a situation where everyone has to burn garnets, then that's perfectly fine for you because you still have some left over.
Yeah, and I also just love the impulse to immediately go and buy these, get the 2 cheapest ones, and suddenly you're getting 2 clues for 7 garnets and someone else now has to pay at least 5 for 1 clue.
Yeah, we actually see this come up in quite a few games where if someone just immediately went to the dealers and bought whatever the thing was that was on offer, that would be the best play because eventually they're going to have to buy anyway or right. Their alliance is going to have to. And so you may as well just get in there quickly, buy it when the price is lower and drive up the price for other people in the process.
Yeah, definitely. And there are also times where people recognize this, kind of like in Survivor when Tony and Spencer both, as soon as Jeff Probst said the word, the next item up for bid, it will be whatever, and Tony says 500 right here, they get to the point, and sorry, I forgot to mute my phone, where there are people asking to start buying stuff before it's even legally allowed to be bought, because they know the advantage now of being the first one to buy it.
Or even before they know what it is, just knowing what part of the auction is coming out. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into that. So some of you now has those two hints, huge information advantage.
Yeah, and another aspect of him buying all the clues up so early is that now everyone wants to team up with Sung-Yu because some of them don't have the garnets themselves to even buy the clues anymore because he's already bought them all and driven the price up. But even the ones who do, you know, they don't want to put themselves in the position where they've burned through all their garnets and now they're only in an equal position with Sung-Yu. So it makes sense for everyone to team up with him, and that's another really big selling point to buying them early.
Yeah, Jin-Ho ends up buying the next 1 for 5 garnets, and then Sung-Yu later decides that he wants the last hint too, so he pays an extra 6, so there's 13 garnets in total here. But you are right, that there's huge value in people knowing that Sung-Yu's the one with the information. He should definitely be able to get his pick of the litter here, I suppose.
Yeah, and it might seem like a steep price to just be buying all of the clues, and not knowing how garnets are going to come into play in the next game, and certainly in the finals, that might be a bit of a risky proposition. At the same time, though, given that there are so few people left, I feel like just maximizing your chance to win this round and getting to the final 3, that's a worthwhile use of however many garnets you have left.
Yeah, totally agree. And so, actually, because everyone knows that Sung-Yu has all the information, he and his boss come up with this plan on the opening round to put chips on a decoy horse. And they end up choosing horse number 6, which everyone was like the one horse everyone knew couldn't win already.
Well, the one horse that a lot of people knew couldn't win, but some people decided to still try and bet on it anyway.
Well, Jin-Ho's friend, I think, put like 1 chip down.
Yeah.
Yeah. But early on in these games, of course, it's just going to be people kind of testing the waters. And there is a lot of, in this game, something I wanted to get to, waiting for other people to bet, because you want to get as much information as you can before you make your bets. Like, there is a huge advantage in going last, So I almost would have liked it, I think, if there was like a determined order. I don't know if it would have been good when they did this back when there were so many people, but I think when it's only four people doing the betting, I would have liked it to see a rotating order here instead of just who can wait the longest.
Yeah, and as long as there's like this tacit social contract between the people not to try and outmuscle each other for position, then it might be able to sustain itself. But I think if you had a group of cutthroat players, all of whom knew that they had to wait to the last possible moment to put a bet in, then the game just couldn't function because it wouldn't actually progress at all.
Totally. So ultimately what this comes down to is HaHa did some phenomenal work here, where he traded clues with everybody before the first round of betting had even began. So it's just he and Sangmin acting like they're fucking around, but instead they're just piling all their chips on what they know to be the winning horse from the opening round. Yeah. Of course we got to talk about what I referenced earlier. My favorite scene, probably of season one of The Genius, maybe of The Genius ever, is Sung-yu misses his sunbae Sangmin because they can't be in the same room and they can't talk this week. But fortunately, they have adjacent rooms, and he decides to write him a letter.
Yeah, this is... I would aim higher than you. I think this is one of my favorite scenes across all reality TV that I've watched.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff involving, like, drama or blindsides or whatever, but just in terms of sheer comic value, this knocks everything else out of the park.
Dear respected Sunbae, this is Sung-yu, who always follows, worries about, and respects Sunbae. And then I love that he sends it with a garnet in it, and then Sangmin cracks up when he receives it and tells him that it wasn't enough. And his follow-up letter is, "Dear respected Sunbae, I love you. Of course I meant to give you more garnets." Yeah. So this is just phenomenal stuff. I love the music. It's like quiet piano music playing in the background. Like lounge jazz almost. Yeah. So that's phenomenal. I can't get enough of that scene. It's still so good, even on a rewatch. Okay. So, shockingly, Sangmin comes in first place here, but the way this works is that not only there are two tokens of life up for grabs, and just the top two finishers get them, and if the partner gets it, it just goes to the person that they correspond to. And Kyungran spends basically the whole time berating all of her partner's bets, saying, "Oh, why are you doing this? Oh, it's not five, it's not five. What's he doing?" But the partner actually was really, really sharp here, where he recognized, because of what Sangmin and HaHa were doing, clearly that was one of the horses that was going to win. And now he played it safe such that he recognized she had to split off to a different horse. And while they didn't know which horse it would be, the only way that she could have even a chance to win is just piling up on five and hoping to get lucky, which actually worked out.
Yeah, and we joke a lot about Sung-yu picking his boss, but I think there's actually a serious point here, which is if you're in a game where your partner is making decisions for you, then you need to pick someone who will listen to you no matter what, who isn't going to go off and do things on their own accord. And it's even riskier in later seasons and potentially in future ones, where the people who you invite to be with you have seen the genius before. They know a certain amount about it. And so just having a chance to play the genius, even if it's just for one episode, is going to have a certain appeal for them. And they might be wanting to do things that don't match into your plan just so that they can have that full experience. And so you really need to pick someone who you know will do what you say. And picking the person who's your boss or even someone who's just on an equal footing with you, I don't think is a wise move.
Yeah, I think Sung-yu's thought was, who's the smartest guy I know? It's got to be my boss, the guy in, the shot caller at my record company. And it was just like a respect thing that he thought, oh, if I have my boss, I'm going to have a huge advantage because this guy's so smart. But I think you are totally right that that certainly the boss is not always going to be interested in listening to what Sung-yu wants to do. Whereas I think someone like HaHa is just totally there to have fun and has no reason to do anything other than help Sangmin.
Yeah. Now, you can think, well, if you're not naturally suited to this game, like let's say in the first Scamming Horse race you didn't do well for whatever reason, then you might pick someone who does have a different like personality type from you so that they can try and take over instead. And we see a kind of hilarious application of that in a later season where someone brings in someone very different from themselves just to slay everyone and keep it and make it go differently. But yeah, I think in the dark, you want to make sure that if you have a plan, whoever you pick is going to follow that plan and not just go off and do whatever they want.
Yeah. So the way this ends up going down is Sung-yu spends 13 garnets and does not come in the top two.
Yeah. And this is almost entirely due to his boss just, you know, who somehow is running a successful record company, by the way. I'm not quite sure how based on this, but
Well, there are a lot of people, like, I would say Donald Trump is a complete moron in general, but he apparently seems to be okay at business and selling himself. So I think it's like a whole different brain than just being generally intelligent, I think.
Yeah, but by the same token then, you shouldn't assume just because this guy's my boss that he knows what he's doing.
No, but it's Sung Yu, come on. So
yeah, that's fair.
I think you are right that in general, partner selection is massive in this game. But to your point, it's not like they know that they're going to play another version of Scamming Horse Race when they're making their partner selections. So they wouldn't have the knowledge that they should be picking someone different than themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. Yeah, so Jinho and Sung Yu, without the Tokens of Life, are going to be playing in the deathmatch. We are playing Tactical Yu Nori again. And this is the episode that goes for like 20 minutes longer than most of the other Genius episodes. And that is because I believe this is the one where the Tactical Yu Nori game just takes a decade.
Yeah. And for us, given that Tactical Yu Nori is both the least appealing and the least understandable part of the show, it's... You know, that's something which you kind of have to skip over on a rewatch.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, they played this with their partners again. So that is another, just another reason why having your partner be a good partner is so important. But yeah, this is the end of Sung Yu. And first of all, at this point, I was happy with any of the remaining three going on to be the winner. I, on my first viewing, was not thinking of Sung Yu as that kind of talented player the same way I was for the other three. Just because I thought Sung Yu just seemed kind of clueless and largely got by on goodwill from Sangmin for the most part. On rewatch, Sung Yu, I may have said this earlier in part one or something, Sung Yu is the MVP of this cast.
Yeah, he's actually a decent player and a phenomenal character. I mean, you know, an absolute home run casting choice.
Yeah. And I actually, considering we've already posted part one and we've gotten some feedback on that, and in part one, I compared Sung Yu to his, like, I said you couldn't find a picture of him on Google Images where he doesn't look like a depressed lesbian. I got a tweet about that from someone who, I think it was a sincere warning, said that he has a ton of fans and I may want to cut it back on the depressed lesbian talk. So I will officially remove that from the record, even though I just repeated it like four more times. Yeah, so really sad now in retrospect to see Sung Yu go here. Although I do, you know what, I do really like that it came down to these three, because I think these three were really fun players the whole time. And I almost at this point was rooting for, it's not that much fun if it's clearly just Sangmin and Sung Yu against whoever the third party has to be. Happens to be, I should say. So let's move on now to Final Three. We are playing the 5-5 game. This is the one where 10 just complete strangers enter the arena. And they have to ask them in 12 Korean characters or less, and I don't know how that works. Tom, you're a language guy. Do you know how Korean characters work?
I know absolutely nothing about how Korean characters work.
Fantastic. So you have to write them a question, and then the goal is to split the people's responses into groups of 5 and 5. You do that, you get a point, and most point gets immunity and goes on to the finals.
Yeah, although not knowing anything about how it works,
yeah,
you can still understand that it's not really analogous to how English works, for instance, where you couldn't really say, oh, do it in 12 words or less, because you could always find some phrasing that makes it easy to do that.
You use a lot of contractions.
Whereas in Korean, I get the sense that that's not as possible.
I think it may be syllable-based in Korea, but I'm not positive, just because all their names have the same number of syllables.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I thought you were going to get into is, it's also worth just not knowing anything about it, is that these players do not know anything about the rules of the game when they have this opening time to talk to these candidates before they have to do their first round of questions. And I think that's massive. I think that's the whole reason that this game could go anything other than everyone getting all of them right for the most part.
Yeah, this was a weird episode. I don't think this game was a particularly strong concept. But the opening banter in this episode, and then when the guests are introduced and they know nothing about what's going on, that's actually the high point of the episode, where the contestants clearly just have no idea what's happening, and so the fact that they're presented with these strangers who they have to try and tease information out of without even knowing why they're doing it, that's actually quite fun to watch.
Yeah, oh, it is. And incidentally, they all ask them all of their blood types, and every one of them knows their blood type. I don't know my blood type. I asked, when I first saw this, I asked everyone in my fantasy football thread if they know their blood type. None of them do. Dom, do you know your blood type?
I have no idea. Yeah.
Wow. So I think that's just something that they do. It seems like it can't hurt, and it's not hard to memorize, so I don't know why that's not more common. It seems like it could come in really handy. Yeah, so what we see as far as strategy goes here, when they don't know, you know, they have their first hour of questioning, and then they find out the rules and immediately have to ask their questions. We see a lot of ors, combining things with an or, which I think is smart. Like, for instance, I am a man or a medium, because she knows there are four guys and one woman who is a medium.
Yeah, I think there's basically no excuse for anyone to drop a point here. Like, maybe if it was an early game and you had people there who weren't as quick at figuring out certain aspects of the game, but I feel like if you get down to Final Three and you're on the Genius, you should be able to cotton onto this game pretty quickly. Not that I would. I would be just kind of bumbling around doing my own thing and not figuring it out, but I think contestants of this caliber should be able to do that fairly easily.
Well, I think in Kyungran's defense, the points she dropped were because a woman gave her the wrong information.
I'm thinking more of Sangmin, for instance, who towards the end does kind of take the same approach, but early on he's just going with the same kind of like birthday things and age things as everyone else is.
Yeah, I guess it's more once you just find out the rules. I don't know how much time you have between finding out the rules and having to start asking, or between coming up with a new question. Like, I'm sure if Sangmin was allowed 10 minutes between questions, he would take it and come up with something.
Yeah, well, as the voiceover says in the program, the easiest way to do this is to give the contestants new information, because they've been instructed to be cagey about what they reveal to you. So if you can create some new information for them, then you can do that on your own terms. And we see Jinho do this, for instance, where I think he shakes someone's hand, or, you know, and so on. I feel like you can just do that as many times as you need to in order to get up to 10. So, for instance, you take five of the strangers aside, you put them in a room, you shake all of their hands, you tap them all on the shoulder, you give them all a piece of paper.
Right.
You know, you do something which they would remember, and you do it in the presence of all five of them so that they know this is what's going on. And so when your turn comes around, you can easily just rattle through all of them and rack up 10 points.
Right. No, exactly. That's what Jinho did, is he went to the same five people, and I think it was he touched the backs of their hands together, which is kind of weird considering he could have just as easily shaken their hand. And then also told them his brother's name. And then as he was doing that, I think he made it clear, like, remember that I'm asking you this. Remember this, that this is happening, because I'm going to ask a question about this, and you're one of the yes people.
Yeah, I think one other way you could do it, if only for one question, is if you have a question which you know you're going to get a 5 and 5 split for the next question, you can say, I answered yes for the previous question. And conversely, I answered no for the previous question, if that's also allowed. And that's an easy way to just rack up extra points.
Actually, if you do it that way, where you ask a legitimate one, and then you say, I answered yes to the previous question, the people who then answered yes would press yes again. And then if your next question is, I answered no to the previous question, all of the no's would press yes, and then the yeses would press no's, and then you could repeat it again with
I think they would put us up to that, but...
Yeah.
I think it proves the point that it's a fairly ill-conceived game, just because kind of stuff is both obvious and impossible to overcome. Like, what happens if everyone just gets 10 points, which should happen most of the time here?
Yeah, well, one thing I've always wondered about is there are games that could theoretically just become stalemates, such as this one. I don't feel like it's much of a spoiler to say we've never seen that happen, but I feel like they've referenced a couple times, I couldn't cite a single time when, but that if it is essentially a tie... an unbreakable tie, it would just come down to whoever has the most garnets is immune. It counts as the winner.
Possibly. I don't know how that would work for team games, where there's multiple winners or people win as a team, but yeah, I imagine there's some kind of procedure in place.
They have something. I don't know. I doubt we'll ever see it, because I don't think they're ever going to run a game that's going to, in practice, become a stalemate. Yeah. Although this is probably the closest they've ever come. So, and let's see. So, Sangmin actually shows... He doesn't do much he does eventually start conditioning people, but before he does that, you know, like, he puts the bracelet on someone, which was a great moment. But prior to that, we saw him really highlight his observational skills here with the question about, like, the socks and the crossed legs and the dress length. I thought this was, like, I liked the game in that we got to see this kind of creative thinking. I honestly wish it was, like, ask the question in 8 characters to really test their language ability.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's not only a bad... game choice in the abstract, but also for the TV show, because it's only interesting when you get to see them going around asking silly questions, which they should only be doing if they haven't figured out the game yet.
Yeah.
So I think in a lot of seasons you reach a point where the people who are still left at this stage of the game understand what's going on, and then you basically have no interesting content for the episode.
Yeah, so Kyungran misses those two because of the weird birthday or occupation or something. Sangmin missed his first two and then ran the table, and Jinho actually ended up only missing one, so he has the first seat in the finals. And now it's actually interesting. I can't believe this, we didn't bring this up at the top. We're now at the final three, and neither Kyungren nor Sangmin has seen a death match yet. But they are about to learn, and they are going to be playing Same Picture Hunt. And this is the one where they have 16 tiles on that kind of Wheel of Fortune square-shaped board. And the way this game works is that Sangmin, because he has more garnets, gets two extra spaces. And Kyungren, and he also gets the option to who will go first. He will, of course, have her go first. So Sangmin is essentially ahead by three turns to start. And we referenced this earlier, that this is the big oversight on Sangmin's part that leads to his eventual downfall here. Dom, let's do some role-playing here. I'll be Kyungren, you be Sangmin, and you be Sangmin as it should have gone down. All right, Kyungren, okay. I'm up first. I'll pick M. M is wrong. Dom, it's your turn.
Okay, I'm picking M.
Thank you. When you are up by three spaces, but where they have to overcome a three-turn disadvantage in order for it to even be a 50-50 shot, when they get one wrong, you just keep mimicking whatever answer they gave.
Yeah, I think the game that most people have played that bears a resemblance to this is the pairs game, where you flip over two tiles. If they're the same, or if you flip over one tile and then it's the same as one that you've seen before, then you flip over that tile and you keep going. A lot of people, when they're playing that game, they'll flip over a new tile, and then if it isn't something which they've already seen somewhere else, then they'll flip over another new tile and just hope that to get it right. When the actual correct strategy for that game is to, with your first guess, flip over a new tile, and then if it's not something that you've seen before, you flip over another old tile, because that means the person following you gains less information to make their plays from. And statistically, the chance that you find the correct tile with your second guess is outweighed by the amount of new information that gives your opponent.
Right, exactly. When Sangmin's just guessing a random tile, it's 50-50 whether he uncovers his own or Kyungren's. And just more to the point, our friend AJ, our good friend of the show, AJ Van Gilder, ran the numbers on this, and he is an accountant, so I believe him. And he came up with the figure that if Sangmin just keeps matching all of Kyungren's incorrect answers without even factoring in human error on her part or her uncovering one of his tiles to bump him up another turn, it is 76% likely that she drops before he does.
Yeah, and even if she does go on a streak and maybe get four or five correct in a row, Sangmin can also just try and do the same, which if he has a good enough memory should be fairly easy to do. So it's not like this commits you to losing if they do start getting it right, because you can just fight back on equal terms with them.
Right, there's no reason to ever stop with this strategy until they have matched your progress, and otherwise there is no reason to ever give them any information that they don't get for themselves, because it's 50-50 whether, as they're just randomly uncovering something, it could help them or it could help you. Sangmin does not adopt this strategy. And Kyungren actually rallies a few times here and takes the lead and ends Sangmin's game. Parting thoughts on Sangmin, because I'm going to start right out and say it. Sangmin is one of my favorite players I've ever watched in reality TV.
Yeah, Sangmin's great. The thing with Sangmin is, if you look at his latter half of the season, like in Open Pass, he didn't really do anything, didn't figure out the strategy that Jinho used, and didn't get a decent score himself. But that's true of most people, so you can't dock too much credit for that, maybe. In Episode 8, though, with Kong's Dilemma, he was the one who tried betraying his team, but did it so badly that he ended up angering both teams in the process and, you know, narrowly avoided being sent to the deathmatch and losing there. In Episode 9, in the Expression Auction, he makes his play early to grab the plus sign, ends up being stuck with it, and then has to kind of fight his way out of that with great difficulty later on. So not a great showing for him there either. In Episode 10, in the Scamming Horse Race, he wins, but I think that's mainly because Haha was doing great work on his behalf there. And then Episode 11, this one, he fails the 5-5 game and then doesn't come up with a good strategy for the deathmatch. So you're trying to make an evaluation of Sangmin as a player. There's a lot to dock points for based on the last few episodes.
Right, but I think the reason that people don't do that is because even when all of that was happening to him, he was so damn entertaining, right?
He was entertaining, yeah.
And I feel, he, like, to the same extent of Will Kirby for me, I just like watching him on TV.
Oh, yeah, he's great. I mean, it's not the same kind of, I'm going to give confessionals to the camera about how smart I am, but it's just that general showmanship, I think, that makes him fun to watch.
Yeah, just like his presence in the game just improves every episode that he's in.
Yeah, and we see in later seasons, there are certain, like, comedians and other people who have this big persona that I think some people, a lot of people find amusing, but other people find grating. Sangmin isn't as over the top as that. He just comes across as being quite normal in that regard. And so you don't kind of like get turned off by him to the same extent if you do.
Right. He's not like a big time self promoter or anything. He just seems to be having excelling at all of the social aspects and most of the strategic aspects, and then also having a lot of fun and is clear. I think Cosmic's a really good point that a lot of the times with Sangmin, it's just because he's so aware of how to make good TV that the episode is so good. Yeah. Okay. So very sad to see Sangmin go. I know just a lot of people as they were watching season one would talk to me about it and say, you know, I Sangmin is my favorite virtually across the board. So definitely I know a lot of people unhappy with seeing Sangmin go there, but what can you do? We will move now on to the finals, and we have Jinho versus Kyungran, and it is best 2 out of 3 playing three matches of one-on-one games. We have roughly 70,000 U.S. dollars at stake. It was, I think, 79,000 Korean, insert Korean currency here. And the players, I think it's interesting, and this happens at the start of all of the finals matches, they get to assign advantage items to whichever player they want to support. And incidentally, before we get on to just the way things went down here, I mentioned the prize pool, and I was curious, and I tweeted this out to see if anyone knew, and huge shout-out to Brian Scally for finding this out. Had no one ever spent any garnets, and none of them had ever been taken away for any other reasons, there would have been 133 garnets in the pool for Season 1. So just note that. So I think that's interesting. And incidentally, good friend Jeff Pittman is going to be getting into the Genius soon, so I am certain that we will have comprehensive databases of all of the statistics in our near future. So the big story now entering here, Dom, is whether or not Jinho can break his second place curse. Who were you rooting for the first time you were watching?
Well, I liked Kyungran enough. I also liked Jinho. Didn't really have a favorite between the two of them, but you have to root for Jinho not to finish second again. I mean, it would be... unless you really have something against the guy, I think you have to root for him here.
Yeah, if George R. R. Martin is writing this, he finishes second. Otherwise, no. Yeah, I was rooting for Jinho just because I felt like, well, I now recognize that a huge part of what makes Kyungran so good is avoiding the deathmatch. I just felt like we didn't see much out of her, whereas with Jinho, he was the leader of that big zombie team win and then also open pass. And I had watched this, you know, 2 days after I'd watched both of those episodes. So I was definitely supporting Jinho here. So the first game that we're going to play is Indian Poker. And the way this ends up going down is that Jinho... ends up getting it in against the second nut low and uses his +2 item, so he knows it's in the bag. And before we get into the actual way this hand played out, I was curious, because there is the +2 item for this game, and there's also the copy item, if Jinho, he didn't have the copy item, unfortunately, could he have theoretically, if you even, I can't imagine why he wouldn't be able to, copy this +2 to make it a +4, and then he can confidently stack off against anything from 1 through 4, rather than just against a 1 or a 2?
Yeah, I feel like that would be such a big advantage that they wouldn't allow that, but at the same time, I can't see any logical reason why they wouldn't, as in, it would be consistent with the rules of the game, so...
Right, they said, at the start of the game, they said the only thing you can't copy is the first game selection and the delete item or something.
Yeah, so let's talk about the game selection quickly, because we have Indian Poker, Same Picture Hunt, so Jinho's done well in Indian Poker, Kyungran has done well in Same Picture Hunt, and now... we have this mystery third game, which we know is going to come second. So that's going to be in the rotation no matter what. So you can't put that off until the end. So whoever gets this game selection item, I think, has a pretty decent advantage, because they can select whichever game they previously won at and which their opponent doesn't have any experience of. And so Jinho gets given that that game selection item, obviously picks Indian Poker, which I think just in the abstract anyway, he would be favored to win because that's well suited to his talents. But given that he's also played a game of this before under these conditions, you have to think he's a fairly big favorite going into that.
Yeah, I mean, given that Kyungran is going to be stacking off against 4 bets facing a 9, yeah, I would say Jinho is going to be a pretty big favorite in Indian Poker. Let's get into that. Because the way this went down is Jinho has a 9, and he raises 5 chips. And then this is not allowed in regular poker. Kyungran just calls his 5 and raises him 1 chip more. Typically, you have to double it. You'd have to raise it another 5. But that's not apparently in play. What else, not a huge surprise, I guess, at this point. He then jams on top of her. She has, you know, 4 chips behind. And she actually calls it off here against a 9 and the guy who's holding the +2 item. Which means even if she has a 10 and he uses that, she can't win. This is a complete charity win. I know that it's kind of human instinct to think, oh, I'm in it this far, I might as well just get it in. There is no way that it's not going to be the end of the end of this match in your loss. So you should always be keeping those extra 4 chips and just hoping to get lucky. Well, first of all, you should not be reopening it. Just call the 5 chips or fold against a 9.
Yeah, I think a lot of idiom poker comes down to, you know, using your intuition and making like a snap judgment about how your opponent's playing. And so often, if you end up going out in what seems like an embarrassing way, it's not going to be because objectively you misplayed. It's going to be, you know, you made a bad read in the moment and, you know, whatever. This is a situation where I can't see any conceivable reason for doing what she did.
Right. Like, there's no reason to reopen it. There's no reason to even call, let alone raise, and then let alone call off.
Yeah, like, even though she was quite far behind at this point, that, in a way, almost makes it worse, because there's, like, this is game over if this happens, and it's almost certainly going to go down this way based on what he has, which you can see, and you know that he has this item, you know that he has the plus two item, and you can be fairly certain that if there's any doubt in his mind, he's going to be using that plus two item, so there's not even any, like, weird thing where maybe he levels himself into thinking that he's got a, you know, this basically is always going to result in disaster for Kyungran, so very strange to see her do this here. Like you said, we hadn't seen too much of her in some of the previous games, but she always seemed someone who was fairly, like, measured and, you know, willing to think it through and come to the right decision. And so for her to just randomly spew off here was quite surprising.
I think maybe one of the reasons Kyungran might have talked herself into getting weird here is, you know, just facing a nine, is I think earlier Jinho was raising three for value and raised five to try to get her to fold a 10 earlier. But even then, I still think calling is probably still bad. And if you have a 10, you have a 10. But certainly reopening the action is not what you want to be doing, allowing him the chance to then re-raise you when he has a nine, and then you know you just can never win. And then certainly calling off when you know he's never doing it if you have a 10 and he's already got a 9 and a plus 2 item. It's just horrible.
Yeah, like, you would think if she was worried about being pushed off a 10, then she would either just call or shove immediately and not give him a chance to do anything else.
Well, no, certainly just call when you're facing a 9. Because if you shove, it just gives... If you have a low card, he's going to call and he has a 9.
Right, but he doesn't know he has a 9. So let's say he's trying to balance the times that he's making a bet this large to push you off a 10 by also doing it when you have some kind of middling number. Then if you shove, he might think, well, even if Kyungran has like a 4 or a 5, he might have a low number, so he should fold. But Kyungran, nowhere in there is there anything that would make Jinho fold, conceivably. So she is basically reducing it to... Both of the cards are going to go face up. Who has the higher card? And Jinho obviously is going to have the higher card because he has a 9, and he can make that beat even a 10 if you have one.
Right, but the point is, if you're thinking about re-raising because you don't want to get bluffed off a 10, he's not going to call against a 10 anyway, whereas he will call if you have a low card, certainly a 1 or a 2, and then he'll use his plus 2 item, and that's the end of the match. Plus, you don't have that many chips, whereas if you just flat, you're still going to win with a 10, and you're still going to lose, but you don't lose your whole stack when the 9 is good.
Yeah, but either way, there's no kind of consistency to the line that she took.
I mean, it's horrible from start to finish. All due respect. Yeah. So that is the end of Indian poker. We move on, all due respect. We move on to, not that she doesn't deserve respect, but we were just so mean to her. We move on to Gil Hap. And this is the new game that we're going to find out about. And this is the one where you find sets of three similar or dissimilar shapes, colors, and backgrounds. And then you call Gil when you think that all of the combinations are out, and that is worth 3 points, and every other combination is worth 1. And with that caveat in mind, at a certain point in each round, it eventually should become a stalemate, because no one wants to call out the last Hap, since it lets the other person call out the Gil for more points than the Hap itself is worth. And the weird twist to this game is that the eliminated people get to participate as well when there's a stalemate between the two, between Jinho and Kyungran. And those points are given to whoever they chose to support with their little snow globes at the beginning. So that is certainly weird. And Dom, any reason why they might do this? This seems crazy to me, right? It seems like, why let the panel influence the final outcome to this extent? Like, give them the items, but this is crazy.
Yeah, I think they're trying to model this general concept of having the eliminated players, of giving them some say in the final outcome. So not necessarily in the mold of like a jury from Survivor or Big Brother, but some way to let them still have some influence. But I feel like you have that anyway with the item selection. I feel like once that's done, let them play it out with whatever advantages they've been given. Don't let the eliminated players basically play for them the way they got to in this game.
Yeah, and I actually, by the way, when they were assigning the items, I liked that they basically tried to go out of their way to make it an even split, to make it an even match.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine times where, like, some very popular person makes it there against an unpopular person, and it is wildly imbalanced, but I think there's a sense of fair play that is fairly pervasive in the show, where realistically that's not going to happen as often.
Right, and that's why I don't like that. I feel like the advantage items are enough for the eliminated players to influence the game, because I feel like the genius really hangs its hat on being a battle of wits, basically, and it's not so much that when you have these third-party candidates giving points to the finalists. Yeah. So, Dom, this game is far too complex for me. I am very bad at Gil Hap. What are the right ideas here?
Okay, well, my first instinct watching this was someone with any kind of mathematical background could find, like, a basic combinatorial solution to this, right? Where it's like, you know, you can tell fairly, where you can tell easily how many haps there must be, and also kind of what they must involve, right? So you know, well, okay, there's this, that there are two white tiles and three squares and one triangle or something. So given that, how many haps must there be and how must they be configured? And we see Jinho kind of reach this manually, where he realizes, well, if you look at all the ones that share colors and shapes and where that's all very obvious, and then look at the outlier and try and build haps around that, then that's a fairly good way of covering all your bases. But I think there must be some way of just, like, looking at a board and instantly realizing what you have to do.
I don't think it would be instant. I'm sure there's got to be some mathematical formula to figure out how many haps there are. I think it would require far too much time and brain power to be pulling that kind of thing off as you see each board for the first time. Instead of just looking for as many as you can, to be focusing on how many there are and then what must go into all of them, like, I think that's kind of a fool's errand that under these circumstances. Although I do agree that in theory it's doable. Like, listen,
I don't think it's,
once you get into the deeper points of the round and start listening, I'm sorry to keep talking over you, but once you get into the deeper parts of the round, start, you know, looking at the theoretical aspects of it. But right off the bat, I think you have to start just getting the obvious haps before your opponent can get those points.
Okay, well, I think, I imagine at least, it would only take maybe a few seconds to figure out, at which point, okay, maybe you've used up your turn that could have been spent calling an obvious hap. But once you know how many haps there are, that's such a big advantage, because let's say you know that there are 9 and 8 have already been called. Well, now that you know that you shouldn't be calling one, even if you do find it, because that lets the other person call Gyul, and also it means if you're having trouble finding it, then you know that you don't need to spend that time looking, because you can deduce what the state of the game must be from there.
I still just feel like in real time, when the game starts immediately and Kyungran is rattling off a bunch of haps, getting all the obvious ones while you're thinking about how many there are in total, I don't see how that's going to translate to more points for you than doing the obvious ones and then kind of figuring out on the fly Jinho style, well, the outlier must be it. I feel like that's honestly a better approach than the scientific method here.
Yeah, if anyone has any ideas on how you could deduce that, whether or not you think that's a smart thing to do, then please do let us know on Twitter or via email. There were two boards in particular that I thought, upon seeing them, were very interesting. The one where it seemed like there were no possible solutions, and one where there was 3 of everything, and therefore there must be, like, every possible solution.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they seem to end most versions of this with the one where there are going to be, like, 15 haps at least on the board.
Right. And so I think when you're being introduced to this game for the first time, you have to imagine that most of the boards will have a few haps, but not too many. And then there's going to be one with very few or maybe even none, and then one which just has a ton of them, that where it's basically whoever can find the most gets a lot of points.
Right. No, I think that should absolutely be anticipated. Yeah. So let's see. What else do you have about? Oh, incidentally, someone sent me an online version of this game where you just find them yourself. I tried it. I played maybe 3 rounds and quit. It was so frustrating. Yeah, I'm so bad at this game. I just keep clicking goal.
I thought it was a really fun game to follow along with, but I imagine if I was trying to do that under pressure in these conditions, I would just fall apart.
That's what I'm saying. I feel like when you're trying to crack the game every single time, you know, I think they play, what, 10 rounds of this? Like, to be doing that mental process, that scientific method 10 times, I think is going to be more harm than good.
I'm saying there's going to be some basic trick to it where it's like, okay, there were 2 of this type and 3 of this color, therefore there must be X haps, right? I think there are some way you can reduce it. It might not be a perfect solution. Like, maybe it's only there are going to be between X and X haps and Y haps, but there's got to be some way to simplify it.
Yeah. No, I'm sure. Again, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is some formula to figure out how many there are. Okay, so the way this ends up and the way the season shapes up is Kyungren uses her double points for the, I think it's the ninth round, just because she's down a little bit. And Jin-ho, with some help from the panel, keeps just building on his point lead. He also ends up getting the six-point gyul there. There's no way for Kyungren to overcome that. In the last round, Jin-ho breaks the curse and is your winner of Season 1. Dominic, satisfied?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think Kyungren was a bad player by any means. I don't think Jin-ho was obviously that much better than her. But, you know, given the backstory and given that this was the first season of The Genius and we didn't have anything to really compare it to, yeah, I thought this was a really good ending.
Yeah, I was really I was going to be happy whichever way this one went. But I was really, really happy to see Jin-ho break that second place curse. Because I think, unquestionably, Jin-ho comes across as really likable. Maybe kind of a goof.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think he's someone who, at least for our demographic, is very easy to relate to and want to see do well.
Yeah. Incidentally, I mentioned having watched that just this one little... he was on one episode of a show that happened to be subtitled in English, so I checked it out. He has apparently got infamously bad pronunciation of Korean words. And we were actually talking about... I'm sure if Korean people listen to this podcast, they wouldn't hear much of a difference between me and Dom. And I was wondering, because if we were just not noticing like these massive accent differences between these players, and apparently Jin-ho is the one setting the bar at the bottom.
Yeah, Jin-ho's poor diction is easily the most relatable aspect of him for me. I wish it weren't so, but it is. It's interesting as well, watching the English subtitled version, where Bumbledly Umptious tries to render the poor Korean pronunciation in English, because that's always like a really fun thing to see. But
yeah. So Jin-ho is your winner. However, Sangmin, as I mentioned before, was another person that really stole the hearts of a lot of the audience. And I think it's an interesting discussion to have, because Koss puts this very well, which is that Jin-ho is extremely intelligent and Sangmin is extremely clever. And I'm curious which play style you think in general is better, because it seems like Jin-ho is more capable at breaking the games, but as we've discussed before, is going to probably position himself to be like the leader of whatever side he's working for and is thus going to find himself in a lot of death matches.
Yeah, Jin-ho is better at like figuring out all the angles of the games and, you know, finding the right approach for his team and then sticking to that. Sangmin is a better hustler, I think. Like, he's better at, you know, working himself out of whatever situation he finds himself in. I don't know. In general, I think Sangmin's approach is going to be better, just because doing what Jin-ho does and being like the obvious leader of a team, as we said, even if that works out in the context of winning that particular game, you can easily find yourself in a tough situation in the deathmatch. And so, you know, thinking long term, it really does depend also on what your individual skills in the deathmatches are, which is why it's hard to weigh people up so easily. But I think Sangmin, on average, is going to have a better performance.
I think Jin-ho, at least out of the Season 1 cast, has an edge in any deathmatch against anyone, any random deathmatch.
I can see that being true as well, but I think that's a discussion that's worth parking for the time being.
Yeah, well, I think just in general, my philosophy is, as I've said a few times, I don't like that Jin-ho is probably going to find himself in a lot of death matches. That's the easiest way to stay out of the death match, or the easiest way to avoid being eliminated is to stay out of the death match. Like the Pearl Islands jury versus players question, the easiest way to not get bitten by a shark is to stay out of the water. And I like that. I think Sangmin's style, he plays to stay out of the death match, and that, at least for me, is what I like to be seeing. That's the person I have more confidence in.
Right. Although I think with his style of play, firstly, you have to have excellent social skills, but also you have to be able to execute that properly. And we do see in the second half of the season a few times where Sangmin tries to outmaneuver the other players and just ends up failing at it in fairly dramatic fashion.
And still never finding himself in a death match.
Well, I don't know how much of that was a result of him doing good work to keep himself out of the death match versus just there were other priorities at the time or just sheer luck in avoiding it.
Yeah, and also just, I'm sure it's not easy to pull the trigger on picking Sangmin to be your deathmatch opponent. Yeah. So I also want to talk about, because for me, I think Sangmin was the most impressive player of this season. And I'm wondering if Jin-ho is even the second best player. I know he won the game. I know he crushed the zombie game and had open pass, of course. But as far as general expectation, I just feel like he's going to find himself in too many death matches the way he plays here. And I got we got an email from Koss again declaring Sung Yu the second best player of the season. Does that have legs for you?
I think this is just Koss being Koss. I mean, I am and will be critical of Jinho when the situation arises, but I think that in general he has a much higher expectation than Sung Yu does. Sung Yu needs to have a good somebody there to tell him what to do, whereas I think Jinho, no matter who he's put there with, will be able to form a decent team, make some decent plays, and have at least a good shot at taking it down.
Yeah, I think Sung Yu was smart enough to follow Sangmin, but as I said before, I think it was largely just goodwill from Sangmin that got him to the point that he was. Like, it takes a special kind of talent, I'll say, to lose that confined scamming horse race spending 13 garnets, to not get one of the two tokens of life there.
Yeah, you could also say, though, it takes a certain kind of talent to lose the same pitch again when you start out with a lead like that. Yeah, I will also defend Sung Yu in that context by saying that I think that was mainly down to him picking the wrong person to add on his behalf, which I think is going to be a big problem some of the time, given how he plays, where most of his game is picking the right person to add on his behalf. But, you know, in a situation where he doesn't have his seemingly incompetent boss there just going off the rails and playing by his own rules, then you might see a different outcome.
Yeah, Sung Yu's someone I definitely didn't give enough credit to as a player the first time around, although I do think Koss is a bit high on him, to put it mildly. And someone that I think most people, even those who've seen all the seasons, may be a little low on. I really think Kyungran has a lot of general expectation in Games of the Genius, just because it seems like that her kind of Amanda Kimmel style is just like Amanda Kimmel, just universally applicable. And she's going to be avoiding the death matches and can certainly hold her own in most one-on-one non-Indian hold'em games, or not Indian poker games.
Yeah, she'll always be there towards the end, I think. I'm not so sure if she can close reliably given that, but definitely someone who will be a contender to win in almost any cast.
Yeah, very big Kyungran fan. Certainly, I think she's someone I'd like to see back for an all-star season, more so than I think most people would. She's really fun.
Yeah. And part of that is just like the paucity of good female candidates, not only across the scope of the three seasons, but just in general. Like, they only start... Okay, the Genius does have this fairly heavy gender imbalance that you would never see on something like Survivor.
Yeah, it is. You know, this season started 8 guys, 5 women. I believe season 2 is 8 and 5. And then season 3 is 9 guys, 4 women. It certainly, you would not see this. I guess in San Juan del Sur, it was 10 guys and 8 women or so, but that was just because a couple got medevaced. And I honestly, it took me a long time to even notice that was the case. And I feel like the show doesn't miss out on much because of that. Like, I don't feel like it's lacking any kind of female representation. I feel like the girls they get do a good job. Maybe not in all of the games, but they at least do a good job being good on TV and not... Like, I don't feel like it doesn't stand out to me that there are so many guys and so few girls.
Okay, I think that's a discussion to say for the general podcast, but definitely something that's worth flagging up at this stage.
Yeah, we'll get to that in the general discussion podcast. Now, Dom, what were your favorite games from season 1?
I might have a different view of this than some people. I really liked the burglar game, the zombie game. I thought Kong Sanama was... interesting so far as it just resembles most other game theory style problems, but I would say over the course of the three seasons, the game selection does get better. Mm-hmm. And there certainly were a few duds in this one, like the 5-5 game didn't work out very well, and I think this is about as well as it can work out. So that one certainly is one to cut. The scamming horse race maybe would be more compelling if they had explained it better, like the way the odds worked towards the end, but that one was a miss for me. And the confined scamming horse race was interesting mainly because of Haha, I'm going to say, and just the general idea of having strangers there helping out. The 1-2-3 game was interesting as like an introduction to the Genius, but I think once people know about it, it becomes fairly easy to solve. And the election game, I feel like it's never going to be very flashy, but you could do it every season and it's always going to be fine.
Yeah. I think people are going to berate you for leaving out Open Pass, but I think that's results-oriented because Jinho found such a sick way to make an episode out of it.
Yeah, it was a good episode, but you can only play that game exactly once.
Yeah.
And that holds for all of these games where there's some kind of trick to it. I mean, once people know about it, then, you know, it's... That is what the game is, so there's no more to see there.
Right. You know, apart, unless you count horse race and then confined horse race throughout all three seasons, at least to date, we have never seen a main match repeated. Yeah, so I think that's interesting. And I like that a lot. I like that they're not playing. Although there are some I would like to definitely see again. For instance, my favorite games from season one, I really liked Kong's Dilemma. I think that's always going to be interesting. I think they could play that every season. And I also, give me some expression auction. I really like that game. I think that's fun.
Yeah, and we do have games in other seasons which are similar to the expression auction, but nothing that's exactly the same.
Well, they're all really good is what's the same about them.
Yes.
And then also, I really liked 1-2-3 as kind of an introductory to the series. I really was a fan of that. One thing that I definitely wanted to bring up, and I don't think it's come up yet, shout out to those dealers. Those dealers, as someone who spent a lot of time with shitty dealers in main casinos, these are incredible dealers. And actually, I think it's worth flagging up. We just know, just from researching a bit, that the lady dealer was initially slated to be one of the players. Because someone said, oh, they should totally have her as one of the players. And it was like, yeah, they actually were going to. But they thought that she was too similar to one of the other women. And I think it was Yu Ram. I think she might be a pool player, too.
I thought it was because Jimmy Cha was there. But
Maybe.
Either way, she's someone who, if they could find a way to make her a contestant, then I think that would be good. Especially since, you know, she's always interesting to watch, especially on the other two seasons as well. The male dealers just kind of are there and don't really do anything, but you do get some fun shots where they're just like standing there like the guards at Buckingham Palace, just like looking really stern.
That's a good comparison.
Like in the confined horse race where Sung Yu's trying to get his letter to Sangmin and he kind of throws it limply into the hall and just like begging the guard to give it to him, and he just like fixes him with his stare. withers and backs away.
Yeah, I think the male dealers always do a good job. And you guys, for people who haven't seen it, we'll be happy to know that these three dealers do stay on for all of at least the first three seasons. And also, while we're giving out shout-outs, how about that soundtrack department, right?
Oh, it's fantastic. The best part is just the seemingly random mix of songs that they find. I don't know if a lot of American or Western music has the same perception in Korean culture. Like, do they think of it as distinct genres or anything? Or is it just, that's foreign music, so let's just get some of that in and it'll be fine?
Well, the thing is, it's like, they must have a monstrous budget, unless they're using it illegally, because they're using really popular songs and songs from really popular movies and TV shows.
Yeah, but I don't know if that, like, are the rules different for that if it's a foreign company doing it, or
why? Maybe. Who knows? I don't know. But yeah, so that, I mean, the soundtracking never decreases in quality, by the way. Always a great soundtrack. Dom, where does season one of The Genius rank for you among your reality seasons?
It's very high. I think, you know, you can ask questions like, on a rewatch, does this stack up better or worse compared to other seasons? But I think just the experience of watching this for the first time and just discovering The Genius as a thing is very high up there for me.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the stumbling upon The Genius and then having this be the end result of it just blew my mind. I would still say that The Genius season one would hold up on rewatch certainly against any Survivor season. I would say maybe Big Brother 7 and maybe one other season of The Genius. As for just overall, this is definitely in my top five reality seasons.
Yeah, and The Genius is a show which, as I said before, I think certainly improves upon at least the first rewatch, because you see, like, you already know what the games are, so you know about all the angles to them. There's a lot of foreshadowing that you pick up on that obviously you're not going to see on the first time through, and there's just so many things where, because you're not focused on actually figuring out the game, you can kind of sit back and appreciate the little things a lot more.
Right, just knowing who the players are, being familiar with them, understanding the game rules ahead of time, and knowing what's coming. I cannot recommend, I think anyone who loved it the first time should definitely make a point to rewatch all of the seasons of The Genius. And I think, yeah, season one is just fantastic on a rewatch. So Dom, one thing that, and I mean everyone says to me is, as soon as they watch it, wow, can we get an American version? That's something we're going to be talking about on our general discussion podcast, which is going to happen after we do our podcasts about seasons 2 and 3. Dom, is there anything else from season one that you wanted to bring up?
No, other than to say go and watch season 2 and then watch season 3 and then go and watch them all again and be ready for when we podcast about those in a few weeks.
Yeah, so next time we are going to be talking about season 2 We're going to have basically what is a diamond power of Vito in play. We have a lot of awesome new characters. There's plenty more epic moments to be getting into. I'm certain you guys are going to love it. And hopefully we can be doing one of these every, you know, couple of weeks. So thank you guys very much for tuning in. Email your questions to us for the general discussion podcast to domandcolin@gmail.com. Questions, comments, whatever. And we will be back hopefully very soon with another one of these. So thank you once again for listening, and take care, everybody. Fighting!